we want to have some discussion of the budget forecast, and obviously we'll have another one out within a month, and we'll have the chance to listen to Dr. Stinson as to what the not the real budget forecast, but the updated budget forecast, one we'll be working with, looks like. There's been a lot of discussion in the last couple of months, and this committee has not had the opportunity to participate in those discussions relative to the administration's position in terms of where we are with cash flow and the possible consequence of short-term borrowing. So we want to have some discussion with committee members relative to that so there's a more complete understanding. And then obviously we have the bonding bill, always a big favorite in even your session. So why don't we start with, are we going to have Commissioner Hansen, Dr. Stinson, Mr. Showalter, whatever you gentlemen would like to do is, and I think we've got, I know members have seen the forecast information, and we've got it in the packets, but so people know the broad strokes, but we'd like to get into some detail as to where we are. So, Commissioner, we have you on, I guess, at the top of the agenda. So however you would like to handle things.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The first part of our presentation will be to give you a summary of our current financial situation, which is going to be a quick presentation of the November 2009 forecast. And today, as it did 2 months ago, it remains a good news, bad news story, and is particularly relevant since you're taking up the bonding bill a little later. The good news is we remain a AAA-rated state, despite the fact that we've been through the worst economy and the worst recession since World War II and the Great Depression. We're considered one of the better managed, fiscally managed states in the country, and we've retained our AAA rating. The bad news is that we're challenged again, as you can see on the bottom of page one, with a $1.203 billion deficit for the remainder of the 2010 and 11 biennium. If you turn to the next page, you can see, and actually that is where I turn it over to you.
We haven't done this for so long.
No, they took one of my slides out. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Stinson, and he'll walk you through the slide on the top of page 2, which will show you which of our revenues declined, and then the economic situation. And he's got some updates, Mr. Chairman, from our macroeconomic forecasters. That'll be new information. The slides reflect the forecast, but he's got it packed away in his head, and he'll provide some newer, fresher information as well. And with that, I'll turn it over to him.
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, at the top of page 2, you can see where the revenue losses came from. Revenues are now expected to be $1.156 billion less than were forecast a year ago. That's about a 3.7% decline.
You bet.
The changes in the corporate income tax and the sales tax are small. Almost all of the decline comes from a decline in the individual income tax. The official numbers, okay. The official numbers the official numbers are $827 million decline in the forecast, 5.5%. But if you do this on an apples-to-apples comparison, it's actually more like $1 billion loss in the income tax. The reason is that some revenues were recharacterized for accounting purposes. The reciprocity numbers were formerly counted as other revenues. Now, because we've eliminated the reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin, those revenues are part of the withholding and not part of other revenues. The forecast, again, down $1.156 billion, 3.7%. Results for November and December were very close. We reported them in the economic update. I've got this number committed to memory. We had a variance of 0.06%, that's about as close as we're ever going to come, so that's why I have it committed to memory.
Is that the best you've ever done, or?
Yeah, I think it's by far the best we've ever done. Part of the advantage is that if you only do 2 months, you can't get too far off in those 2 months. But we also have preliminary information on January receipts. We haven't finished completely processing.
I'm sorry for interrupting you. We apparently are having. Apparently, we need some financial support here in the committee. Apparently, the mics are working for committee members, but not at the witness table. We're working on that.
Okay.
So maybe just, Commissioner. No, it's not. No, Commissioner, this is not one we're blaming on the administration. This is something internal to the state senate.
We manage the building.
Yeah, they do.
So it might be us.
Blame them.
Pardon?
Blame them. It is. They run the building.
Well, and the commissioner just said that. We didn't hear that because the mic's not working. So if you could just maybe, till we get this fixed, just speak up a little bit.
Okay. For January, we haven't finished looking at the receipts yet, but at this point, it looks like we'll be positive a little bit. Not a lot. There's no big windfall or anything like that. But there will be a little bit more money, it looks like, than we thought in January. So things are headed in the right direction. The question that everybody has is why revenues are down. And the answer that everybody knows is that it's because the recession was longer and slightly deeper even than we thought. The big thing that was different in this forecast compared to what we thought was going to happen in February of last year, you can see on the bottom of page 3, and that's the change in U.S. wages, total wages paid to everybody in the country declined. Global Insight had a decline forecast of 0.4%. It turned out that the decline in wages was much larger than that. It now looks like it was around 4.5%. And this is something that we just haven't seen before. We haven't seen it.
It kicked in. The microphone kicked in.
We haven't seen it for a year since World War II. The impact of the lower wages, of course, reduced our income tax receipts because Minnesota wages were lower than we thought as well. And that's the source of almost all of the decline for tax year 2009 and a substantial portion of the decline for tax year 2010. If you look at the top of page 4.
Dr. Sins, if I could ask you, relative to your comparison to World War II, at what point was that for the first year out of the war, the last year in the war, and was the decline in wages at that point a direct reflection of where the country and the world was in terms of World War II, so that this is even more serious because we're not coming out of some cataclysmic world event such as that?
Mr. Chairman, during World War II, we had a situation where a large number of people were out of the labor force serving in the military, and so the numbers for World War II in terms of economic activity, measuring economic activity and things like that, just are not considered to be very well, it's not normal times or anything like that, and so what we're really talking about is after World War II, once people came home, once people began being hired back, we did not see any declines in wages at that time. One of the things that you've probably heard me talk about before is housing starts numbers, and that in 2008, housing starts were the lowest they'd been since World War II. Of course, course, during World War II, we weren't building very many new houses, and so that was, again, one of these situations.
So I guess you're making my point. World War II was an unusual event. We're not in the midst of any kind of unusual event like this, like that.
No, certainly so, not.
So what does that suggest for the future?
Mr. Chairman, I would disagree with that adamantly. You don't think that this doesn't resemble something along those lines?
Well, that's what I'm asking Dr. Stinson.
But you've got all the...
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that what we're in right now resembles World War II. Now, you can say that we're in a crisis period, and we certainly are in a crisis period economically, but in terms of the global implications of this in terms of quality of life for individuals all over the world and things like that, World War II was certainly a much more severe shock to the entire system than the economic crisis of 2007 through 2009.
So do we come out of where we are, or is there going to be 5 years from now some, I guess I've heard the phrase, new normal that will be governing in terms of where we're going economically?
Mr. Chairman, the situation that we're in, the concern is, let me put it in a different way. If you look at what's happened to employment in the United States since 2001, since the start of the recession in 2001, what you see is we have fewer jobs today than we had in 2001. We actually have fewer jobs today than we had in 1999. So what we've done is we've lost a decade in terms of job growth. And that's a serious thing. If you look at the construction industry, we've lost more than a decade of job growth in there. Those are serious things to happen. And the concern is a legitimate concern, is whether coming out of this we are going to lose another decade, whether we're going to be something along the line of the Japanese economy and how the Japanese economy has not done well since really the 1990s, the early 1990s. So that's the concern. But it seems to me that it overstates the problem to compare it to World War II or anything like that. That's just such a severe shock to the system. I mean, this is a severe financial shock to the system, but it's not the same as World War II.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
You know, we can talk about all these numbers and everything, but, you know, if you got your boots on the ground in Afghanistan or Iraq or some other place, you would disagree with that, Mr. Stinson. Now, I understand and fully respect your analysis from a numbers perspective, but from the crisis that's going on inside families, inside Minnesota families, American families, this is bad. And when you look back at World War II, you know, the reason why some of those numbers, those job numbers were so skewed, especially with wages, is because all the men went off to fight wars. The women went into the factory, learned how to weld and use drills, and they built the machines that the men fought with. The problem was they were getting paid substantially less than the men on the line right next to them, and that's why that huge drop of wages happened. Now, and yes, there were a lot of people out of work at that time, too. But if anybody thinks that what we're going through right now doesn't equal in terms of emotional toll on families that are out of work or they have their lead breadwinner earning their bread in Afghanistan instead of in the United States, I can't agree with that. As a matter of fact, I disagree with it adamantly. And, you know, you can look around the room, and it doesn't take too far. You know, you can talk to anybody at the Department of Veterans Affairs or anybody that has to deal with some of these issues coming back from Bosnia and Afghanistan and this war on terrorism, and it's equal to or greater than the emotional upheaval of World War II.
Well, I don't think Dr. Stinson was suggesting to the contrary. He was
Well, we can talk about numbers, Mr. Chairman, all we want, and you know, that's fine.
Okay,
but
thanks.
You know, sometimes people get elected around here to do to look at the numbers, try to make informed decisions, but to look at the ramifications those have on our families. We need jobs right now, so.
Delay of payments.
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, on the bottom of page 4 is an indication of what has happened to wages and employment in Minnesota in 2009. What you can see is that we thought we were being conservative in our forecast. We had Minnesota wages declining by 1.4%. Now, when I talk about Minnesota wages, what I mean is total wages paid to everyone in the state declining by 1.4%. That would have been an historic decline. Instead, what it now appears is that total wages paid in Minnesota fell by 5.5% in 2009. About 4%, 4 percentage points of that comes from lower than from the decline in jobs. The rest of it comes from lower hours worked, a decline in hours worked, a decline in premium pay, and very slow growth in average wage per hour. Regionally, we've done some stuff, and there's more detail in the economic update that we issued in early January, but the quick version is that regions of the state that did worse than the statewide average in job growth were the St. Cloud area, the Twin Cities, and the Iron Range. Regions of the state that did worse than the state in terms of the decline in wages were the Twin Cities and the Iron Range. We can talk more about the economy and the economic outlook if you would like, but the bottom line is that the forecast that we have currently, which is the January Global Insight forecast, is not materially different from the forecast that we had in November. And so while there are little things that are more optimistic and other things that are less optimistic, it's if we were to use the January forecast, we wouldn't have much of a change in the outlook. The February forecast we don't have yet from Global Insight. We won't get that until next week. We're not expecting big changes, but you know, something could change that would make a difference for us in there. At this point, we're not expecting a huge change, you know, for the projected deficit to go away or for it to double. We're not expecting that. Certainly there could be changes of 200 to 500 million plus or minus in the outlook, and that will, of course, we'll be telling you on March 2nd.
And obviously you're not in a position to jump the gun on that, but what you're suggesting is as we look at the national indicators, the unexpected increase in the GDP from the fourth quarter, the greater than expected job loss from the last jobs report, we shouldn't, at least as a finance committee and a legislature, shouldn't expect some you know, big gift wrapped up by the finance department that our deficit's now $100 million for the rest of the biennium. We're not going to see anything like that.
No, that would be a surprise if we were to come up with a number like that. Quite a surprise.
So members, don't count on that one. Go ahead. Dr. Stinson, let me just ask one other question then. What you indicate you're not going to get in, and we ought to have a discussion at some other date as to where we are with Minnesota's economy, but when you present information to us that our job growth is now you know, behind where things are happening nationally, where we have certain industries that no longer exist in Minnesota, where should we go? What I mean, that's too broad of a question, but if you can offer some quick thoughts as to what we ought to be doing as a state legislature relative to that, and not necessarily the Finance Committee, but the Finance Divisions, the Policy Committees, all of us.
Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of facts that need to be made clear. And the first is that since the fourth quarter of 2007, Minnesota has actually done a little bit better than the U.S. economy in terms of employment. We've lost on the order of 4.8% of our employment. The U.S. economy's lost around 5.2%. And so that's not good news or anything like that, but we're actually doing a little bit better than the U.S. economy has over the last 18 months or so. The second thing that you need to understand is that the construction industry in Minnesota has done markedly worse than the U.S. economy and both over the short term and over the last 10 years. The manufacturing sector has done slightly better than the U.S. economy, but it's a pretty dismal record both for the U.S. economy and the Minnesota economy. And looking as to what could be done in the short term, as I've said numerous times before, there's not really very much that can be done in the short term to stimulate aggregate demand by state government. That's really what we need is for aggregate demand to increase until there is demand for additional goods being produced. Jobs programs won't make any difference because if you don't need to hire anybody, even if it's a good deal to hire somebody, you won't hire them. Now, given how long the lags are and given the expectations for what's going to happen, it may be appropriate to be putting something in place that will actually start to have something, some impact next November or December or January or something like that. But in terms of very short-term actions, really the only thing that I can think about is asset preservation through the capital budget that would have a short-term impact. Looking out a little bit longer, really the place that the state government can play a role is, 3 to 5 years or more out into the future, and that is just by building the framework for increased productivity of the workforce. That's really what the game's going to be all about for the next decade or more is productivity of the workforce. That's something that Minnesota's been successful at competing at for a number of years, and we just need to make sure that we're still maintaining our competitive advantage in terms of the productivity of the workforce. The numbers are going to improve. The employment numbers are going to improve. They're going to improve maybe in February, but certainly in March, April, and May because of the hiring that's going to go on for the census. The national numbers are going to be positive. Minnesota's numbers are very likely to be positive over that time. And the real question is there sufficient momentum in the economy to keep growth going after the census workers begin to be laid off late next summer and early next fall? And that's the time that we have to be focused on in terms of making sure that the economy is still running well.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Foley.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Stinson, when you look at this, my reading of history seems to be somewhat different than yours in that I look back at the depression that we had and how we went through the 30s, and then World War II came along, and everyone figured that this was a change, but really we didn't reduce the problems until well after the war is well in the way and even beyond that. So looking at those, what does that tell us about what the likely success on those years that you're not talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, I don't think that it's appropriate to draw parallels between what went on in the Depression and what went on in what's now being called the Great Recession. In the Depression, we had unemployment rates in excess of 25%, and those unemployment rates were applied to a situation where there weren't dual-income families or any social mores were such that if you had a wife, if you had a wife, only one person in the household would work, that it wouldn't be appropriate for one household to have two jobs and the other household to have no jobs or anything like that. So the level of stress and the level of economic deprivation during the Depression was, you know, an order of magnitude greater, a substantial order of magnitude greater than we have at this point. That's not to downgrade the extreme problems that we're having now. It's just that it's appropriate to keep things in focus. The Great Depression went on for more than 10 years, and that was where we had really declines in output, not just very slow growth, but declines in output went on for a number of years.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Stinson, when you look at that, though, that the society was in a much different role in those years preceding the Depression and into the end of World War II, and there were agricultural environments more than anything else. Many folk lived on land and were able to survive the Depression because of that. That isn't happening now, and we have considerable more concentrations of population, and I just think there's a significant difference between those periods. I don't know. The other thing before I let you go is what growth or loss goes in the AMT area, or commercial real estate, rather, whatever that is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, I agree that the situation was way different during the Depression than it is now. That you're absolutely right. People were able to live on subsistence agriculture. Much more people were able to, you know, provide food for themselves by having a garden or having a cow and having chickens and things like that than we do now. At the same time, the social infrastructure, the social safety net, is much larger now than we had at that time. We didn't have Social Security. We didn't have food stamps. We didn't have a large number of those social programs that are playing an important role in keeping things. With respect to your second question, which is the question of what role, and I'm not quite sure whether you're talking about commercial mortgages or whether you're talking about residential mortgages, here, but what role the tight credit and the problems in the credit market is having on the outlook. The reason why we don't, if you turn to page 3 of the handout, and look at the top chart on page 3, which says, this recession has been more severe than those of 1990, 91, and 2001. got this?
Yeah.
Okay. You can see that for the most recent four recessions, what we saw was 4 years after the recession started, GDP was about 10% above where it was when the recession started. This time, because in part because of the length and depth of the recession, but also for another reason that I'll get to in a moment, we expect that GDP will only be about 3.5% higher than it was at the start of the recession. Part of the reason for this slow recovery is because we had this long extended, this is the deepest and the longest recession that we've had since the Great Depression. But another reason why we expect that it's not going to, the recovery is not going to be quick, is because of the massive losses in wealth that individuals have suffered. From peak to trough, the combination of the losses in housing value and the losses in financial assets totaled more than $17 trillion. We think that what's going to happen is that because there's a larger proportion of the population that is approaching retirement age than we've had in the past, that people are going to be more anxious to rebuild their retirement accounts than to start spending once they're feeling more comfortable with the economy. And so that gives us a much slower growth in consumer spending. That gives us a much slower growth in demand for goods and services, which causes the demand for employment to not go up as much as it would have otherwise. So that's the interaction going on there.
Appreciate that.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Mr. Stinson, you mentioned that one of the things that we could do with bonding that might be helpful is asset preservation. And it seemed like you kind of focused on that. I've been a big proponent of asset preservation the last few years and bonding as well. Is that preferred over new construction? And if so, what would be the reasons for that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, my focus is what gets the money out as quickly as possible and gets it into the system, and what kinds of activities hire the most individuals. Okay, so if you have a choice between two different projects, one is a purchase of land for a park and the other is improving the trails in an existing park, purchasing the land for a park is not going to provide you with the same number of jobs as cleaning up the trails per dollar spent or something like that. So that's part of my preference for asset preservation. The other part of my preference for asset preservation is that the largest losses in employment in both in numbers and in percentage terms have come in the skilled trades, not in the heavy equipment and not in the building, the large building construction industries. Now, those industries have been hurt, but the place where we've seen the largest drop-off in employment has been in the skilled trades, and those are the people that are more likely to be able to be employed in asset preservation. And so it seems that it gets at the problem a little bit better. And then the numbers, I've been quoted as saying that $100,000 in capital budget yields one job. That's not what I've said. What I've said is that for asset preservation, $100,000 yields one job. For other kinds of activities, the number is much higher, so you get a bigger employment bang for the buck and in asset preservation and in other things.
Mr. Chair.
General Blaine.
Do you also think that if we're looking for the skilled trades, that the jobs would more likely stay with state workers, people who live in the state? I mean, we had a discussion yesterday in capital bonding, and there was concern expressed that some of the the big projects would be let, the bids would be let to out-of-state companies, and it does happen when you have really big building projects going on. I would imagine, though, asset preservation, which are smaller projects, would be less likely to be let, or bids going out to out-of-state companies, and we'd have more local employment. Do you think that would be the case, too?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, you know, I really don't have any information on that. But I think that the smaller the project, the less likely you are to have large interstate corporations bidding for it, obviously.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for Dr. Stinson? Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. I will pick up the presentation on the next page with a couple of items from the spending side of the November forecast. As this information has been before you for a while, I'll go relatively quickly, just highlighting a few things, but happy to drill in further as you wish. The first slide just shows that there was very little change in the spending in that November forecast. You see, in general, education tracked pretty much as expected. Property tax aids and credits was up slightly. Health and Human Services was up slightly, and I'll explain that in 1 second. Debt service was really the only other major element of spending change, and that was really related to interest rates and premiums that the state was able to receive from the market. Those numbers, however, are all based on several key items that are noted in the following slide. First of all, they are including the effect of legislation from last session and the governor's administrative actions and unallotments. That has some revenue impact, mostly spending impact, that is folded into these figures. So that's the reference point for these figures. Second of all, it includes the impact of the line item general assistance medical care showing no funding in 2011, and also the impact of those enrollees going to Minnesota Care. Why is that important? Besides all of the policy reasons that go with it, it's a significant financial impact on the general fund, and especially a special impact on the Minnesota Healthcare Access Fund. There is current statute that says that Minnesota Care enrollees, the financial resources shall be there for Minnesota Care enrollees during this biennium, and that there is a transfer from the general fund if those resources aren't there. Because of the transfer of the GAMC obligation, that kicked in, and you see about $111 million transfer from the general fund to the Healthcare Access Fund, which is largely responsible for the shift that you see in the human services number in the previous slide. Finally, this includes no direct impact from the federal stimulus funds. Those are largely, those are in a non-general fund, but they do lower some of the general fund obligations. So, for instance, medical assistance spending is lower because we received additional what's known as FMAP, or federal matching funds, during this biennium. In addition, some state stabilization was received. That lowered some of the direct spending for K-12 education, higher education, some of our state-operated services, as well as corrections during this biennium. Those programs had additional federal money coming in from another fund to maintain some of those spending levels, but for the general fund purposes, our spending was lower. We just as a update, we have just concluded the second quarter of reporting on federal activities related to stimulus. That information is going onto our website, I believe, today, so there'll be additional mapping, searchable reports on that information and how Minnesota is using that money.
Senator Berlin.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Showalter, would it be a fair statement to say that the idea of auto enrolling GAMC clients into the Minnesota Care program would be spending money we don't have?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I think at this point we are facing a roughly $1.2 billion deficit in the general fund, our healthcare access fund, with the transfer of enrollees into the healthcare access fund, is also going to put that fund into the deficit. So I guess as neutral and fact-based as I can say it is, right now both funds have obligations and expectations that are well beyond the resources that we have currently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this was more of a statement than a question, but I don't believe the statute gives the administration authority to auto-enroll all of the GMC clients into Minnesota Care. And furthermore, if it did give the administration authority to do so, they would be doing it more than once. They would be doing it every month. So I certainly hope that we can find a better solution to this problem.
Mr. Chairman, sure. Senator Berglund, I think we hope so too.
Thank you.
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, the next slide just again underscores the situation on the general fund side, and that as you go into fiscal years 12 and 13, that the outlook worsens. Some of the one-time resources that I mentioned from the stimulus bill will have gone away. And so as a result, the deficit that we're looking at right now, given current projected spending, current projected revenues, shows a deficit of around $5.4 billion during that 12 and 13 biennium. That is including several major assumptions that we're articulating here, including not including inflation, including the complete repayment of the K-12 deferral that was included in the governor's administrative non-allotments, no repayment of the property tax recognition shift, and no continued GAMC spending. These are all very large items, well beyond the usual caveats that we would put on a 12 and 13 projection. And I think just suggests the level of uncertainty and level of questions that the state has to resolve in putting its financial projections together. So that is a quick recap of the spending side. I know we want to get to cash flow and the capital investment bill, but happy to take questions.
Senator Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Showalter. You mentioned it did include the $1.8 billion that was cut from schools.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it includes the 1.2 of it. There's basically two different shifts that were done or deferrals that were done at that point in time. One is the property tax recognition change. That takes effect in 2011. The other one is aid payment. That reduces the proportion of payments that are going out in of the appropriation in any given year. That second one is the one that the governor's authority really is only temporary. And so that one very clearly has no ability to continue that lower payment shift level into 12 and 13. As a result, we're assuming that the legislature and the governor would also ultimately enact appropriations to repay that money in fiscal 12. That's worth about the $1.2 billion.
Could you just, Mr. Chairman, could you just mention what would happen under the governor's proposal for the borrowing from the school district's reserves and when that money would go back?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would be happy to. That's a great transition if you want to the cash flow discussion, because that is one of the items we will be getting to in the next presentation.
Okay.
If it would be all right if we could hold that over to that.
For the questions from Mr. Showalter, Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Showalter, so that slide right there that you just mentioned, if you add in inflation, we've got another $1.2 billion problem.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't delay the payment, that's another $1.2 billion on top of that. If we repay the property tax recognition shift, it's a half a billion. And if we continue the GAMC spending, it's another billion. So it could potentially be $8 billion in 2012 and 13.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the one item that goes other ways, then we've already built in a complete repayment of that aid shift into the 5.4 number. So it's really not an additive figure.
Okay, so that one.
That's already
that,
in
that
there.
One we don't add.
You could actually reduce that figure by just putting into statutory language the 7327.
So the potential could be about $7 billion then.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. Senator, the number you're looking for, you add 5.4, 1.1, the 560, 2, and then the 928. That gets you 7.
But that should provide some reassurance. It will only be 7 instead of 10. Is that okay? Further questions from Mr. Showalter? Okay, well, thank you. Then I think we want to invite Ms. Cardell to join us. And members, since this committee last met, the department has talked about the possibility of having to engage in short-term borrowing. So we want to ask, find from Ms. Cardell several things. What's being done preparatory to that, and also have a little bit of a discussion about what past experience has been, since I don't think anybody at this table, with the exception of Senator Berglund, Senator Frederickson, Senator Stumpf, as I'm fond of pointing out, I was in exile during those years and wasn't in the legislature. But most members of this committee have not were not involved in the 81-82 discussions. So, Commissioner, how would you like
Senator,
to proceed?
Just a couple preface comments before I turn it over to Mr. Showalter to walk through the presentation. We do not have to short-term borrow at this time. But as I talked about at the beginning of the presentation, we're a AAA-rated state, considered one of the best investment risks in the country compared to our peers. One of the aspects or one of the what AAA-rated states do in situations like this is we transparently and openly talk about what our options are in the case of our cash flow and our budget reserve, which we have always had a fairly a consensus. You know, we've disagreed on a lot of things, but we've always kept a cash flow account, we've always kept a reserve account, and we've gotten credit for that. The reason we're talking about and we started raising our cash flow issues in November is because, as Jim will show you, our numbers have declined, the amount of money we have on a daily basis, and I felt it was necessary to engage in the conversation. And then I think it's also necessary to find out how much it would cost and what the terms are if we should one day have to short-term borrow. And it's better that we do it in this form than at the last minute if it ever is to happen. So it's in that context, Senator, that or Mr. Chairman, that we're bringing it up.
Okay, I appreciate that. And members should be aware of the fact that the Legislative Advisory Committee met a couple of days ago and had some of this same discussion, which was instructive for myself, not having the full sense of history. That the commissioner and others in the department have had conversations privately with me, but in terms of having a fuller exposition, this is, as I said, the first opportunity for this committee. Although we would also, I'd also like to ask for a little bit of historic context as well as we're talking about it, because the commissioner's correct that at this point they're trying to take some preparatory steps in the event that there's a need. If I'm not mistaken, I think one of the differences between today and where things were back in the early 80s is that statutory changes were made where you're coming to us and appreciate, obviously, in an advisory capacity. There's not the need, given some of the statutory changes made in the early 80s, I believe, for explicit legislative action. We obviously could do something by statute if we so chose. But in terms of the department's ability to move ahead, some of those statutory changes from the early 80s have allowed you to proceed as you're doing.
Right. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Showalter now. But just so the members know, we, while you weren't in session, we have had multiple meetings with the legislative committee and planning and fiscal policy subcommittee on the balanced budget. Did I get
yes.
that right?
That's correct.
So since early November on this topic. So.
Yeah, and I would second that. You've had meetings with the commission, the LAC, and individual meetings extensively since November. Mr. Showalter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second presentation is, I believe, with you, and I'm going to try and make sure that everyone has some grounding before we talk about some of the more topical items. First of all, cash management is different than the budget. I was just talking about the forecast. I was talking about anticipated spending and revenues over the course of the biennium. Cash management is even
Mr.
more.
Mr. Showalter, I'm sorry. We've got a number of things in front of us. This is the document you're looking at.
That is right.
So everybody
Cash management isn't talking about revenues and expenditures over the course of a biennium over a two-year period. It's talking about how they match up on any given day. And what's the accumulated amount of money that's with the state in the state's cash accounts at any given day? It's more volatile. It's more sensitive to changes in payments, the economy. And as a result, weak revenues, the changes in the economy that Dr. Stinson has talked about, have started to and continue to worsen the state's cash position. Changes and disparities between the state's revenues and expenditures have been there for years. We always, for many years now, have made local aid payments early in the fiscal year, tend to make slightly disproportionate amounts of K-12 payments in the first part of the year, and our income taxes don't come in until later in the year. Even within the income tax stream, you think about it, most of our refunds oftentimes go out well before we end up cashing the checks for other filers. So all of those differences in timing get washed out in the forecast and in the budget discussion, but on a cash management basis, they're important.
Thank you.
What's happening is the balances that we have as a state have continued to drift downward over time and is making us more vulnerable as those imbalances, because we don't have enough balances to just walk through and work through those lower periods. We've usually been using internal borrowing from other state funds. I'll talk about how we've done that in the past and the levels that we're at right now. But that's usually how the commissioner has the authority to exercise some financial management just to keep things working. Going ahead, a combination of budget balancing actions and as well as administrative actions are going to be necessary to manage through the cash shortfalls. There are periods right now that, absent any action, we wouldn't have any cash as an entity. That would have serious impacts on the operations of state government, as well as everyone we serve, work with, and that's really just not acceptable. There's a lot of more detail than what I'm about to provide to you. It was at the request of the legislature, we provided a detailed cash flow report that's available on our website. It's a very good resource. It's the first time we've done that for many years, and it includes much of the information you're about to see here, plus much more. Narrative to also explain it in, I think, perhaps a clearer way than sometimes it allows you to go back to
Mr.
see.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up comment. In better times, we have the $653 million budget reserve, and we have the $350 million cash flow account. So you have roughly $1 billion around to manage cash flow. We used the last of it a year ago in December 2008, the final 155 in 2008 in our budget balancing measures at that time. So we lost the $650 million cushion, and we're still working with the $350 million as cash flow. But that has had an impact. But the other thing, I look at it as a continuum. Your best-case scenario is in a cash flow situation, if you got a two-year time period, your best case is all your money comes in on the first day and all your expenses are due on the last day. Well, then you got 2 years and cash flow is not a problem. Your worst case scenario is all your expenditures are due on the first day, but you don't get all your revenue until 2 years later. And now we're obviously somewhere in between in that continuum. It's my simple explanation.
Continuing on, as you see in the next page, there's two slides. These might look familiar to some of you. We, in fact, presented some of the same information before the Senate Finance Committee last year. The notion here is very simple, that amongst all of the activities that the state has, there's something called state invested treasures cash. That includes pension funds, constitutionally dedicated funds, all of the activities of the state. Within that, though, the commissioner really only has authority to manage across funds in the statutory general fund. Those funds, as of June 30th, 2009, had about $2.4 billion in them. And you see the balances by fund below that. Going ahead, just from June 30th of 2009 to November 30th of 2009, you see the deterioration in the balances. This is anticipated. This is part of the cyclical nature of our cash balances. But it gives you a notion of how things work. The statutory general fund, all of those funds that I mentioned, the general fund, health impact fund, special revenue fund, healthcare access fund, MinSCU, and lots of other smaller funds, only totaled $834 million in cash balances. The general fund was the drag. The general fund's imbalances were what were moving funds and reducing that total overall cash balance. You see, as of November 30th, a balance of $41 million. The only reason there was $41 million in there is on the next column, you'll see that there is a $945 million of interfund borrowing. That's a fancy way of saying we moved cash resources from other funds totaling $945 million to make sure that the general fund still had enough cash to reach 41. So roughly $900 million a cash flow deficit in the general fund. The amount borrowed by fund follows below that. See $55 million from the Health Impact Fund, so on and so forth down that list. That interfund borrowing is not entirely unusual, and I'll go through that in a second, but that is the way that we are able to manage through the course of the year our message to the Senate Finance Committee, to the House Finance Ways and Means Committee, and the LAC the other day is that this is reaching very low levels, and levels that are going to be difficult, if not impossible, to reach, to manage. You see, as of December 31st on the next page, that just how volatile these figures are. Again, just in a couple of, between November 30th, where we had $834 million, by December 31st, we were back up to about $1.1 billion, or $1.056 billion. So again, these figures change on a daily basis. They, in fact, change on an hourly basis. But this is the notion of we are moving funds from other funds into the general fund to make sure that the cash is there. The funds that are lending the money are not harmed. They will get the money back. That is part of our projections. They receive the interest as if the money was always there. It doesn't impede the activities of these other funds either. But it does help you understand the overall context that we're trying to manage.
But the difference as to where we've been in the past is we've had a reserve to use, cash flow account, and I don't think the cash flow account was created in during that period in the early 80s, I think.
You want that too?
Yeah. Mr. Monson says 83. So when we did this before, there was no cash flow account, which you had, and you've had the advantage of that this time around.
Yes. Mr. Chair, that's true. The cash flow account has been around for quite a while, but you know, even at $350 million, which has been its nominal level for probably two decades now, its buying power isn't nearly what it used to be. And having no reserve, having used that up in earlier budgets, you know, basically leaves us with not much cushion within the general fund itself. You see on the next slide just how that historically has looked. Some of the interfund borrowing that we have done from the general fund starting in 2001, so you can recall those were relatively good years. And so the general fund's balances were up, the reserves were fully stocked, and then when we started to hit the recession, we started doing significant interfund borrowing. As we started to pay off, restore some of the reserves, started paying off some of the shifts, we were able to start to lessen the amount of interfund borrowing, but that snapped back as this recession has hit us. This is not an entirely new issue. Those imbalances between timing of accounts has been there for years. What we're really looking at now is just the levels and the lack of other options, such as the cash flow account or budget reserve.
But the other another difference, and we don't know where 2011 might be, but when the problem existed in 2003, that was a one-year cash flow problem. Now we've had, at least according to your chart, 2 years of cash flow problems. At least my definition of that is that where the reserves have been under $1 billion.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I think the huge difference between 2003 and today is that there was a $1 billion tobacco endowment at the time. It was outside of the general fund that by law was then basically moved into the general fund, and that $1 billion resolved a lot of our cash flow issues, the interfund borrowing that you're looking at here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I'm just curious about it's before this. It talks about the past decade and the borrowing. Was there borrowing before this past decade? Or you guys were around, I don't know, in your current position.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not sure. We were trying to figure that out. We don't think there was any borrowing probably before 2001. The accounting system switched over in 95, so we really don't have a good record prior to that. In the late 90s, there was almost certainly no borrowing because things were very flush at that point in time. So I wouldn't expect it. I'm not sure what would happen in the mid-90s. No more questions, and I'll continue on to the next page. And you just see the declining cash balance at the year end. This is very much related to that interfund borrowing. You see back to 2001, we had $2.6 billion in ending cash balance in the statutory general fund. Over time, that has dwindled. By 2009, that had dwindled to about $837 million. And by 2010, that's going to decline to $412 million. So that lower starting point, of course, exposes the variances over the course of the year. You start to see that in the next graph. That the highs and lows are marked here. So that vertical line shows the high point in the month for our cash balance. The low point is the low point of the line. And the hash mark shows the ending balance for the month. So, for instance, in July, you see that the high point was about $2.5 billion. The low point was around $1.7 billion. And the ending balance was probably $1.8, $1.9 billion. That continues on. And when we started to have concerns, well, we knew we were going to reach a low point in this October, November, December timeframe. We talked about that, as the commissioner mentioned, with the LCPFP subcommittee, and talked about the options and management strategies we used to get through that. We withheld or delayed some of the refunds on corporate tax refunds and sales tax refunds. That saved us some money and allowed us to have an adequate cash balance so that significant expenditures that were happening around November 30th were able to take place, and then our cash balances started to rebound as anticipated. Looking forward, we're seeing anticipating further problems and probably slightly more severe problems in the months of March, April, and May. And those are the points that we're looking to try and resolve. On the next page, you see just a little bit more information on that next low point. That we're assuming about $400 million of working capital is necessary, that we really can't manage to zero, because that would pretty much seize up all operations, trying to figure out what fund is about to make the next payment to get the cash into it so that that would work through the accounting system. It would not be a tolerable situation and would lead to even more risk of interruption of services. Given that, there's the low points in March are estimated to be $227 million in March, a negative $143 in April, and May, $19 million. So we're looking to find about $500, $550 million of improvement in our cash position during those months to make sure that we've got adequate working capital, to make sure payments are made on time, that we've got some buffer against just small disruptions, small changes in timing of payments, as well as just the likely risk that something we won't be perfect in our daily estimates of these cash balances. To give you an example of just how much they can swing, we'll go there in a second. 2011, the picture is worse. So we're really managing through two separate problems. One is the short-term problem of several months, several low points in the mid part of the month. 2011 is worse. This is not building in a balanced budget. This is built based on our November forecast and is assuming that it will get better as legislative action, as the budget becomes balanced. That does not move all the lines up, though, by, say, $1.2 billion. Depending on what the solution is and how the timing of those actions, it might move it up by the end of the biennium, but it almost certainly won't help us immediately and in that kind of amount. So that's a second problem and a very significant problem that we're looking forward and trying to figure out how to manage and to make sure that the legislature is aware of those issues. Continuing on. You'll just see a brief discussion of some of the primary factors that are driving those low points and the timing of revenues and expenditures. That bottom slide on that page really just shows you the revenues and expenditures in any given month. And you just see that, you know, the revenues really, there's 2 months where we have significantly more revenues than expenditures. They're December and June, and to a small extent, April. Other than that, there's a number of months where it actually drives the other way. July, August in particular, March, February, March as well. So there's just several points where the revenues aren't coming up nearly as strongly as the expenditures. That's the cyclical problem that we see every year. To continue plowing ahead and just to get to your questions, cash balances can vary widely. We're giving you projections of very, very low levels of detail. We're giving you nice summary levels of information, but really, on a daily basis, these figures can jump by hundreds of millions of dollars. When you see here, just during the course of August 1 to August 29, you see some of the differences in revenues and expenditures, and you can see quite easily how, on any given day, that low point might change simply because, well, the payment didn't come in until August 13th that it came in. Or we didn't send it out on the 13th, we sent it out on the 12th, and suddenly our balance would swing fairly significantly. The balance between these two is important. That's what you see on the bottom part of this slide. We've got lots more information and detail in some of the following sheets, but I want to just conclude by some of the short-term actions we're looking at in fiscal 10. There's three major authorities that we're proposing to utilize. One is the Higher Education Authority in 16A 152. We'll be delaying one payment to the University of Minnesota for roughly 2 months. That has an impact that you'll see in the following chart. There's holdbacks in payments to school districts under MS 127A.46 is already in statute and is really pretty prescriptive as to how we should make changes in our payments. And then there's also the assumption of some delay in some of our corporate and sales tax refunds as we did this fall. The fiscal impact is shown on the bottom of the page. And you'll see here a brief summary of our cash estimates over the February to June period, the month-by-month impact of these actions, and the low point that we're trying to manage to over this period.
Mr. Chairman.
There's Tom.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Showalter, earlier you mentioned that when you borrow from these different funds and within at the state level, the interest that's earned on nothing's affected. You said that those funds continue to earn interest. In the case of school district, where you're withholding the payment to the district, and the district has to use its reserves, does the state make whole the interest that's lost to the school district too?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no. We would if we could, but the statute really does not offer interest. It does not issue any guidelines for interest. It's really a payment delay, so it's not an interest arrangement. There's no interest payment that goes with it.
Okay. Are there other entities that we borrow from, like special taxing districts?
Senator, the only other item in the you see here in the list is just that delay of the University of Minnesota payment. That also isn't interest bearing. There's no anticipated changes to special taxing districts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, you can see we start running out of good ideas or good options.
Mr. Chairman, one other question I had. Have you estimated how much help it would be or whether it's even a good idea to change sales tax payment dates and what impact that would have on on the state's revenue picture, cash flow revenue picture?
Mr. Chair, Senator, excellent question. It's actually one of the items that's discussed in our cash flow report. There's a couple of different, really within the month time dates that are really important to managing these low points, and would like to continue discussing those and if there's any flexibility to changing some of those.
Mr. Showalter, I don't want to interrupt you, but I know Ms. Cardell apparently has to leave at some point.
10:15.
Okay, and so we want some discussion from her as to what the process is and what's happening right now. So I don't want to interrupt you, Mr. Showalter, but I know you want to make sure she gets an opportunity to talk to us.
Absolutely. If I could just make one final point, and that is that school district payment delay, I think, is already pretty well known, but that statute hasn't been used for many years, and as we tried to understand the impact of it and how to utilize it, it became very clear, based upon bond counsel advice, that the commissioner and the administration really has to use that, that we can't access short-term borrowing unless we have fully utilized existing statutory authorities to avoid short-term borrowing. And that is one of those bulwarks to make sure that the state doesn't try to go and borrow.
Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Olson.
Question to that point. The calculation that you have used in the first exercise of that requirement did index or extrapolate out the $350 per student amount that is in the statute, and it was set in 1986 to a higher level of 700 and some. Now, when you say you haven't used to the fullest extent, does that mean that at a future that will suffice now? That if that's left in place, that technically you might have to go back to the $350 dollar per student that is in the statute before you can do any short-term borrowing?
Now, Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. Yes. Before we could do short-term borrowing, we would need to use that payment delay to the fullest extent, which is roughly more than $900 million of delays, as opposed to the 422 that are currently proposed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, if you look back to the charts that Mr. Showalter has walked through, it becomes more of an issue in 2011 than 10.
Okay. Ms. Cardell, or?
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Kathy Cardell, Assistant Commissioner for Treasury and Debt Management at MMB. I'm assuming, Mr. Chairman, you just kind of want me to walk through a similar discussion of the request for proposals?
Yes.
Okay. As we presented to the Legislative Advisory Commission on Wednesday morning, I think it was, MMB has now issued a request for proposals for a line of credit or a private placement of short-term certificates of indebtedness. There's a one-page little summary of that RFP, which I believe you all received. And I will run through the basic terms and conditions. The amount is not to exceed $600 million. The purpose is to increase the state's liquidity and smooth out these fluctuations, as Mr. Showalter described, with respect to forecasted state receipts versus disbursements. The security for these obligations is the full faith, credit, and taxing power of the state. It is a general obligation of the state. It will be repaid, and a tax would be levied if necessary in order to ensure repayment. The source of repayment are the collections of taxes that are levied for and any other revenues appropriated to the state's general fund during the current biennium, which ends, of course, June 30th, 2011. The next two points on the table are important. We've tried to structure this request for proposals to allow us to consider an array of possible options for how we might address this problem if and when we need to. And I'm going to skip to the second one first, actually, the flexibility point. We've structured this to allow for potential respondents to bid on providing either a line of credit to the state, a private placement of short-term notes to the state, of the state, or both? And there's some differences in the characteristics of those two financial tools. A line of credit is something that a bank, in the way we all think of a bank, typically would provide. That would be potentially something where we would set a maximum amount, draw down on that as we need to. Once we draw down on it, we start accruing interest on and paying interest on what we've drawn. We repay it at some point. A private placement will operate a little bit differently than that, in that it will look more like a bond, except a very short-term bond, in that we would presumably issue a fixed amount. That entire amount would be placed, in this case, using the private placement tool with large, sophisticated investors. One of the questions that we discussed at the LAC meeting on Wednesday morning was the nature of those types of investors. Again, I cannot say for absolute certainty. I don't know because we haven't done this. But we would anticipate that those would be institutional investors, most likely large money market funds. That is the one segment, actually, of the municipal marketplace that has actually continued to function reasonably well. It doesn't pay a lot of interest on any of our money market balances, but the demand for those for this type of short-term obligation has continued to be very high. So with the private placement, the entire amount is placed. We pay interest on the entire amount beginning immediately, and again, we would repay it at some determined maturity date, not later than June 30th of 2011. The interest rates could be either fixed or variable with a line of credit. Again, we have not received responses, obviously, but I would fully anticipate that we would have a variable interest rate. We would pay interest monthly on that. With a private placement, could be either way. I'm thinking it's probably more likely that it would be a fixed rate. We've also allowed for these respondents to offer us both a tax-exempt product or, depending on their interest level, and or a taxable product. And that is important also, although perhaps less important if, in fact, we are successful in managing through the rest of this fiscal year with the administrative actions that we've already put into place. The reason for the opportunity to do taxable or tax exempt is that we have a term limitation under federal tax law for what we can issue on a tax exempt basis, which is not more than 13 months. So, for example, if we had had to, do some sort of a borrowing now or in March, and structured it so that we could repay it in June 30th of 2011, that term exceeds what could be done on a tax-exempt basis. So we were looking in the context of this RFP to give us as many potential options so that we could array them and select amongst them depending on the circumstances that we are facing at the time we may need to use it. The criteria for selection is here. It's based on, obviously, the cost to the state, also the acceptance by the proposer of our terms and conditions as we've laid them out, and also experience working, offering these types of instruments to other states and large local governments. We released the RFP yesterday afternoon. One thing that has changed since the LAC meeting on Wednesday morning is that given the commissioner's confidence that we will be able to manage through the rest of fiscal 10, we actually extended the due date by one more week. We're having proposals back on the 25th. There's no point, there didn't seem to me anyway, that there would be any value to us by forcing people to respond in a very short time frame, and the 3 weeks would have been a more normal time frame for something like this, so we decided to offer that.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Cardell, a couple things.
Sure.
First of all, I've tried to become a little more educated since we had the LIEC meeting a couple days ago. Now, there's a statutory authority as to what the borrowing limit could be. I think that was part of the 81, 82, 83 statutory changes. And is that a billion or 900 million or something?
It's a larger number than 600 million. Yes, sir.
Do you know what that number is?
It's approximately on the well. I don't know the exact number under the state statute. Under the current cash flow projections under the federal law, theoretically we could borrow up to the maximum deficit projected in fiscal 11, which is 1.7 billion, I believe, is the max. We, practically speaking, we cannot borrow the maximum that we might need because we cannot demonstrate under current law that we could repay it.
So if that was to happen, you'd have to come back to the legislature for further statutory authority.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure we would come back to the legislature for further statutory authority or not. I guess it would depend on the circumstances.
The second, it's not so much a question because you were helpful the other day, but I think something important for members, because I asked some questions about what happens if this doesn't work out,
right,
and the state of Minnesota faces foreclosure. And you made it, I think that was the phrase I used, you made it clear that that would not be the case because there's this constitutional provision, which I'd not been aware of, that apparently in the event there is some kind of default, it falls back on property taxpayers. And I forget now, maybe Mr. Watson can help me, I forget what section of the Constitution that's in, or you might have it in front of you.
Well, I've got a lot of paper in front of me.
Well, Senator, or Mr. Chairman, I do want to remind you, we are, as a AAA-rated state, we're always cited for the fact that we prepay our interest payments 18 months ahead of time and are considered a incredibly good credit.
And I don't dispute that, but I...
No, but I think that is very, very important for everybody to know.
There are a couple of comments, but I want to, because Ms. Cardell, you have to leave. Questions for Ms. Cardell. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm wondering what you anticipate the interest rate you would be paying on this short-term borrowing.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, obviously that's one of the reasons why we are soliciting proposals. We have a sense that on a tax-exempt basis for a 13 or shorter term, we would pay something probably less than 0.5%. If we needed to utilize something that had a longer maturity, which I'm not foreseeing now at this point, given the administrative actions that we are implementing, it would be higher than that. I'm guessing, I hesitate to guess. I'm probably double, so maybe 1%, a little over 1%. I mean, in the context of things, interest rates, short-term rates today are incredibly low. So the interest expense will be interest expense. But relative, I know I've been in some hearings on this issue where people remember back when the state borrowed in the early 80s. At that time, short-term interest rates were very, very high, double digits, I believe, in some cases. And it was considerably a different environment then than where we're at today, where short-term rates are so, so low.
And, Mr. Chairman, I guess this would maybe be a question for one of the other two gentlemen, but are we forecasting this interest then into our future budget needs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, at this point, no. It's not built into the November forecast. It would not be built into the February forecast, but at some point, if short-term borrowing were authorized and were made, those debt service payments would show up in the debt service line in the fund balance at a forecast. So it would be built into that forecast if this came to pass.
Okay, Ms. Cardell, I think you have an interview of some sort. Are there questions for Ms. Cardell before she has to leave? Other questions for Ms. Cardell? Sarah Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I missed a couple minutes, but I'm trying to understand how this works. And Ms. Cardell, you said something about how we wanted to borrow $900 million or so, but we couldn't really afford it. We couldn't afford to pay it back. And what do you mean by that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson. What I mean by that is that if you look at the cash flow projections that are attached to, I think, Mr. Showalter's cash flow presentation in the back, you would see that absent a budget solution that materially improves that cash flow situation, that we would have a maximum deficit of about, in the statutory general fund, of about $1.7 billion. The ending balance in June of 2011 is about a little bit north of $500 million. So we would not be able to demonstrate that we could repay if, in fact, we borrowed the maximum at June 30th of 2011. Does that help you?
Yes.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Sir Berlin.
I hate to do this, but, you know, this might relate to what she is telling us. So at some future time, you're saying we would be building this into a forecast, but it would be after the legislature is done dealing with trying to restore balance to the biennial budget?
Mr. Chairman, do you want to do it?
Well, I think if it was going to, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I think the time period, you know, we dip in September, October of this year. So that would be after the legislature. One of the reasons we wanted to do the RFP now is to try to get a sense and share with you what the costs would be so we can figure out how that would happen.
Right, and if I could just add one more thing, Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, when you look at the cash flows for fiscal 2011, it goes south very quickly. I mean, we're positive in July. We're barely positive in August. And so the concern was, and I will confess, I pushed the commissioner on this for doing this RFP now, so we did not want to be in a situation after the legislative session in June where we're trying to do something for July. It's just the time frame. I mean, these things will take some time to put into place. They're not something where we discover on Thursday that we will need money on Friday and we'll be able to just do that.
Sir Metzen.
Yeah, you know, the rates are pretty low, and that's not going to cost us a ton of dough to borrow in interest this money. But what concerns me more than anything, I think, is what the bond rating people will do to – coming up in this meeting is anticipated $1 billion worth of projects that my mind, I've gone through this a couple times, are good projects. But how would Moody's and the rating people, they will look at Minnesota and say, look, they have a cash flow. They can't even pay their bills. We have to borrow the $600 million just to keep government going. And you have a way to repay it in 13 months, and I understand that. But the New York bond rating people will look at this and say, oh, my gosh, you know, they can't pay their bills. And then I think that might have you – what's your answer to that? I'm more concerned about the future of what we have to pay in rates for these issues here.
It's one of the reasons why we're using our other statutory authorities.
Yeah,
Ms. Cordell.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Metzen, that's a really good question. We have been, I would say, extremely proactive in keeping the rating agencies informed of our cash flow situation now for many months. We shared with them, obviously, the cash flow report that the agency prepared. You know, it's difficult to say for certain that if we needed to utilize short-term borrowing, that our ratings would be reduced, but it is certainly entirely possible. But as the commissioner just pointed out, I believe that we are also being recognized for utilizing our management tools that we do have so that we can avoid and hopefully completely avoid having to do any sort of short-term borrowing ultimately.
Yeah, I don't know if that answered my question, but do you anticipate, Mr. Chairman, when you put this money out, will there be, in addition to the interest, a fee? Usually when you put out a RFP for something like that, it's not just the interest rate. There's a fee attached up front.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Metzen, there will always be costs associated with the short-term borrowing, just as there are every time we sell bonds for capital projects. You'll have legal costs. You'll have underwriting costs. you'll have a number of costs.
Okay, let me put it a different way. In addition to the actual costs, the counseling and the filings and what have you, in addition to that, they usually add a fee on top of the actual costs. Are you tracking with me?
Well, we'll know.
Mr. Hansen knows it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll know when we get the, and that's why we're doing the RFP.
That's the fee.
Yeah. Well, you can't estimate or you think, okay, but just keep in mind that there might possibly be, in addition to the interest, of a pretty good fee, probably.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Anderson.
Origination fee.
Sorry, was that a question? There would be, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that there will be, at least among some proposals, for the line of credit, there will very likely be an origination fee.
Ms. Cardell, I know you have to leave for a fairly important meeting, so I want to excuse you. What I'm hoping we'll do, and I want to continue the questions with the Commissioner, Mr. Showalter. This has been affected, I'm assuming, Commissioner, that you'll come back to the LAC with the terms and of what's been promulgated, possibly presented to the finance committees of the respective bodies, but certainly to the LAC as to what's going on.
Yes, Senator. Or yes, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate what we've received from you, and let me just make a couple of comments. First of all, I'm convinced from, the time you've spent with this committee, this last hour, the time with the commission, the LAC, the time individually I've had the opportunity to talk to both of you, that the department is moving in a very careful and methodical way, is doing everything in concert with present statute. What concerns me, though, is if we take a combination of what we heard from Dr. Stinson earlier, that we're in some uncharted waters in terms of where the economy is, that we're looking at economic numbers that are not compared to, say, the early 80s, but to the coming out of World War II, obviously, 60 years ago, 65 years ago, that this is a very unusual situation. Second, I'm not sure in terms of the number of years, if we drew a comparison as to, let's say, if we go into the next biennium, the 12-13 biennium, and we look back 10 years, how many years have we been in deficit versus any other 10-year period? My guess will be that we will have been running deficits more during that decade than previous decades. Third, Mr. Showalter, in your chart, in the charts you presented, it showed that for these 2 years, we have a cash flow reserve in greater jeopardy for the 2 years running, whereas in the 2000, you only had the single year previously. And as pointed out, the utilization of the tobacco endowment came into play, and that lasted some time to allow for the cash flow reserves. I've tried to do a little bit of work, and I'll be blunt with, or be honest with the help of Mr. Mossman, and trying to look back to some of the previous history. And the only time we really have any previous history would be the early 80s. And apparently Governor Cui came to the legislature asking for accelerated income tax payments as a first step. That didn't work. There apparently was on the books some limited ability for short-term borrowing, but the governor then came back to the legislature to increase that statutory authority, which I think is what you're operating under right now. And then subsequent to that, there were some safeguards put in place, which you've also utilized in terms of higher ed reserves and school district reserves. My concern is that, and this is, and I'll fault the legislature as much as the administration, that it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, that we look at the near term. We got a $1.2 billion deficit to deal with this year. Dr. Stinson's comment was, we don't have the final February forecast, that it's probably going to remain a comparable number, would be the expectation. So that's kind of what we're all looking at. How do we get out of the session by the end of May, balancing the budget. But in terms of the long term, my fear is that this is going to be ongoing for a number of years. And the Budget Trends Commission talked about establishment of a very significant budget reserve. We now don't have the budget reserve. We don't have a cash flow account. And there's no discussion, certainly from the administration, to be fair, probably from the legislature as well, of how we reestablish the fiscal stability of Minnesota to keep away from this feast or famine. You know, we balance the budget by the end of the session. We engage in the short-term borrowing, and we're okay. Well, then we come back for 12-13, and we're not okay. Then do we have to borrow again? And are we in this ever-deepening cycle of it just gets a little bit worse, a little bit worse, a little bit worse? And there's been no discussion of whether or not we just kind of bite the bullet, to speak in cliches, and reestablish a budget reserve, a significant budget reserve, reestablish the cash flow account, and try to get away from, I use the other cliche, feast or famine. It's mostly famine these days. And I've not seen any of that forthcoming from the administration. We've done a little bit in the legislature, but we haven't taken that step. We haven't. I suggested last year that we try to budget for some reestablishment of the budget reserve. That didn't get very far. And I wasn't talking about a $1.5 billion budget reserve. I think the figure I threw out was a $500 million budget reserve. And that fell on, that was met by deafening silence throughout the building, whether it be administration, House, or Senate. If, in fact, we're in an economic cycle that is something that we haven't experienced before, that we don't come out of the recession with high growth, and nobody, I assume, expects that we'll repeat the latter part of the 90s, when do we start building back the fiscal stability in some of those respects? And you can answer yes or no.
Well, yes. Well, first, Mr. Chairman, we still have the cash flow account. It's just not enough. We don't have a budget reserve. We have a cash flow account. And as far as I'm concerned, I would love the more the better as soon as possible on the budget reserve. I mean, I would love to have a very large budget reserve. And when you were in the Capitol and proposing it, I must not have been in it, because I will always advocate for a high budget reserve. Our dilemma at a time where, there's the disagreement on whether we raise revenues or cut expenditures, establishing a budget reserve right now means you're taking money away from some other program at a critical time and in a critical need. And that becomes a difficult selling point for you and I to get any kind of a budget reserve. But we're fortunate that we have in statute from the past, when we do have a surplus. So even if we, for example, have a surplus in the February forecast, which I don't know what it'll be, it's not out of the question, but if it's $50 million, it will be applied to the formula, pays off the shift, goes to the budget reserve, cash flow, and then the airport fund. We have at least a mechanism that pays, that builds these reserves. And we built them back after, if you remember, after the 2003 session, we depleted our reserves and we shifted and we bought all of that back fairly quickly because of this statute that we all agreed upon early in the governor's term. It was a bipartisan agreement. So I think we have the tools in place.
So far as the shift is concerned, because that wasn't, correct me if I'm wrong, that wasn't based on the statutory authority for the shift, so that's kind of outside the statute in terms of repayment.
Right.
Again, I want to choose my words carefully. I'm not suggesting that the department, under your leadership, has not been quite careful in what you've been doing. And to the contrary, I think you've erred on the side of safety. But in terms of the larger kind of global effort to get out of this and to try to establish some fiscal stability for the long term,
I'm not sure I'm hearing it from anywhere. Now, obviously, Commissioner, I don't know what your plans are a year from today. Maybe you'll be part of the next administration.
I don't think so.
You don't think so? Well, don't sell yourself short. I mean, there'll be plenty of opportunities.
I'm going to go grow potatoes somewhere.
There's always a demand for those.
No, move to Chisholm in Virginia and be Thomasoni's constituent.
Potatoes too.
Yeah.
Short growing season potatoes.
Obviously, this administration, I mean, the governor said he's not going to run for re-election. So unless something changes drastically between now and whenever we establish the date for the closure of filings, we assume the governor sticks with that. So obviously, he's not going to be here a year from now, at least as governor. But it's been a disappointment, and to be fair, exacerbated by the November forecast, which is as negative a forecast as I've ever heard, not just simply in terms of the dollar figure, but just the long term. And let me just make a plea. We certainly can do some of that as a legislature, but it would be great, given the abilities within the department. I mean, every time I hear anybody testify from the agency, and not just the two of you, but the other folks working with you, Ms. Cardell is an example, I'm always impressed by the competence of the folks within the department. And you would be the best repository for some attempt to lay out a plan. The Budget Trends Commission did that in a kind of outline fashion. You could put some flesh on that in a way that would be of great benefit, not simply to the legislature this year, but to the state government for the next 10, 20 years, and hope you might avail yourself of that. We certainly could do some of that within the legislature. We have people like Mr. Mossman who are very good, very creative. We don't have the staffing capability that obviously the agency has. So that's my plea.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for agreeing.
Thank you. Good luck on your bonding bill.
Any other questions for comments, questions for Commissioner Hansen, Mr. Showalter? Certainly appreciate your time. Obviously, discussing what's some fairly significant problems, to say the least, and your approach to them. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody want to take up the bonding bill? I don't know.
Yeah.
Do we have an author?
Do we have a bill?
Oh, we got a bill. It's in front of you.
It's the thick one, huh? With the small print? That one.
Yeah, it's the billion-dollar bill.
That's why it's thick in small print. Can't read it.
So we assume Sarah Langseth is Ms. Bavine is. Nice entrance, Sarah Langseth.
TV.
There should be music or something when he comes up, don't you think?
Okay, so we have in front of us Senate File 2360, Senator Langseth, for the Committee on Capital Investment. Senator Langseth.
I think half of you here were on my committee and heard it all. I suppose you don't want to be bored with all the details. But the bill in a lot of ways is kind of what we've done in the past. We usually have about one-third of the bill for higher education. And as you see, the front page, that's the list we have. Normally, we have about twice as much money for Minsk U because it got 50-some campuses than we have for the U. But if you paid attention to the other body, they are $34 million behind us on the U, and I think that's very bad policy. But I suppose I'm not supposed to mention the other house. I guess that's something. But anyway, it's all relative anyway, I guess. But if I don't know, is there any comments on the front page? This is all owned by the state of Minnesota. sort of indirectly run by the state of Minnesota. It's our responsibility, and I think we've had pretty much a consensus that somewhere around a third of the bill should be higher education. But if there's any comments on that, probably not. Well, I don't know. Of course, the chair isn't. Mr. Chair, do you want us to go through every line here? Or?
Well, sir, I guess if you could maybe offer the highlights of the bill, what you're attempting to accomplish with the bill, some comments about where we are financially with the bill, either through yourself or Mr. Jensen, okay. And then we'll.
Yeah.
I know there are going to be some amendments, and we'll have the opportunity for questions. But maybe just offer some sense of what you're trying to accomplish.
Well, just speaking somewhat generally, I heard the statement a year ago from somebody that Minnesota is already hopelessly in debt. Minnesota ranks 42nd in the United States in per capita state debt, and that comes from the Tax Foundation. We're one of seven states that has a AAA bond rating. The interest rates, and I don't know, somebody probably knows more than I do, maybe Matt, 3.5%, or isn't that about what we're paying on interest rates now? You don't know. Okay, but about 3.5%, and the bids on most of these projects is coming in like 15 to 20% below what they expected. So it's sort of a sale going on out there. We get the money very, very cheap. We're in a very, very sound basis as far as our debt is concerned. So it just makes good sense to have a fairly robust bill. The difference between the debt service in this year and the next year, there's 0%. That's over and above the projection, which is for a $725 million bill. So it's kind of the difference between ours and the governor's is zero this year and $2.5 million next year. And then it ratchets up somewhat as you go out. But, you know, if we go to work on much of this year and even some the next year, the spinoff and the money we get back from it and sales tax and income tax and everything far more than pays for the debt service over probably the next 3 years or so. And beyond that, of course, the value of the projects themselves will really kick in. Many of these higher ed projects are total renovations. When they totally, at Morehead State, they renovated two buildings now, in the process of one and did the other a while back. They were built in 1932. They totally gutted out. They refurbishing them. The energy cost drops, you know, I've heard as much as in half. When they do this. So there's just an awful lot of value to these buildings once they're ready to go. So that's kind of the general argument for a fairly robust bill, but also the timing. We've never done it this fast before, and it's caused some problems because we did it so fast. But if we can do it early now, the bidding process can start, and many of these projects can be off and running as soon as the frost comes out. If this gets kind of bottled up and we don't come out with it till the end of April or so, many of these projects, instead of being started this year, will be pushed off to the following year, when I think the bids will begin. Hopefully, the economy will be picking up, and there won't be the good deals that there is now. So that's kind of generally speaking as to why we think we should come with this size of the bill now, and also why we should go early. And I guess that's the general argument for the bill. What do you want me to do from there?
Certainly, so it strikes me, and I know there's been discussion about the size of the bill, and I don't have exact comparative figures, but we've passed bonding bills that have been of comparable size in the past, where if you project it out, I'm thinking of what the bill we passed, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, for instance, that by a comparison of dollars, today's bill ought to be much larger.
Well, they weren't much larger, but they were this large and a little bit larger. I think right around the billion mark. But like you say, it was back when the general fund was quite a bit smaller than it is today, and so on. I probably should also mention, we had this sort of thing that was floating on in the air there about it wouldn't go over 3% of the total budget. When revenues dropped 18%, all of a sudden that less than 3 became about 3.5. The administration come out with these new guidelines, which reflects much more what the bonding companies look at, percent of personal income in the state and so on. According to those guidelines, this particular year we could have a bill for $1.7 billion and stay within those guidelines. Now, I think if we did that probably in the future years, it would probably drop down. And obviously, I don't think we would even get support among this committee much for that large. But we're well within those new guidelines. And the fact that we've had the kind of discipline we've had, I think, is the reason that we're one of seven states that has a AAA bond rating.
Okay, thank you. Senator Stumpf.
Is it time for amendments? I just have a couple clarifying amendments.
Yeah. Well, let's see if we have questions.
I think maybe people want to know a little bit more about the bill first. But
if you don't mind waiting, Senator Stumpf.
In my committee, we went through it kind of line by line.
And obviously, Senator Langseth, I think on your committee we have, what, 5/6 of the Senate who serve on the committee? So
we have almost half the Senate there.
So many people on this committee serve on your committee have heard the bill in some detail.
But Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, there are some of us who don't serve
on
that.
And that's exactly, you anticipated me perfectly.
All right.
And I was going to say, and there are some people on this committee who don't serve on your committee who I'm sure would have some questions about the bill who have not had the opportunity.
Well, and Mr. Chair, if we could get a little more of an overview. I mean, this was moving very quickly. And I
suppose
guess
within 15, 20 minutes, we can go line by line through it, and like we did in my committee, if you want to do
that. Yeah, if you could offer some sense of what you're doing with the sections of the bill, that would be helpful.
Well, just try line by line, and it shouldn't take all that long. Just go ahead. I'll comment on a few things as we go along.
Okay, under the Department of Education, the Red Lake Schools, it's $5.78 million, and that's for just part of their project. Library Accessibility Grants, $2 million. The Minnesota State Academies in Faribault, $500,000 for the Blind Campus residential construction, and $2 million for asset preservation. Purpich Center for the Arts, demolishing the Alpha Building, $755,000, and the Windows Project at the Delta Dorm for $489,000, and a prefab storage building for $129,000, and that's to store the things that are being stored in the Alpha Building. Under the DNR, we have $4 million for dam repair, and that covers, I think, 10 dams. The diseased shade tree removal, $2 million. Flood hazard mitigation, $70 million.
I probably should mention a little bit about that. Just recently, they came out with a projection about flooding this spring that could be as bad as last summer, or last spring, and I think you all saw the TV and so on. We can't do anything about this next flood. But, you know, the difference between 1997 and 2009, those two severe floods, we spent quite a bit of money. The amount of damage that occurred in 2009 in the Red River Valley compared to 1997 was a small fraction because of the things we'd done. We more than got back our money that we spent in the fact that it averted so much damage. But we got a ways to go. I think in the next couple of years we could probably protect every city in the Red River Valley if we have adequate funding, with the exception of Moorhead. And there's a Moorhead-Fargo flood control Corps of Engineers project there that would be like a 10-year project. I think it's fairly safe to say that if we could get the $70 million this year, that is probably far and away the most that we would come up with in the future. So the money we've spent, we've already gotten it back probably a couple times over, and this would do the same. So just go ahead.
Forest stand improvement, $1 million. Groundwater monitoring, $1 million. The Hennepin County Fort Snelling Upper Bluff building renovation is $1.2 million. Minnesota Forests for the Future, $500,000. Native Prairie Acquisition and Development, $500,000. And the dredging at Lake Zumbro, $3.75 million. RIM Critical Habitat Match, $2 million. Forest Roads and Bridges, $1 million. SNAs, $500,000. State Land Reforestation, $3 million. And then we have several different parks and trails sections. For the state and regional parks and recreation areas, $8.3 million. And you'll see where that money goes on the spreadsheet. And under state trail connections, for rehab, we have $5 million, and then acquisition and development, $20.935 million. And again, you see the list of the trails that are being covered. Regional trails, connections, and other projects is $5.718 million. And again, you'll see the amounts going to each. Statewide asset preservation is $7 million. Two Harbors Campground expansion, $1 million. Wildlife and aquatic management areas, $1 million. Under the Pollution Control Agency, $500,000 for the Becker County Transfer Station, $5.8 million for the closed landfill program, $5.075 for Purim Resource Recovery Facility, and $6 million for the Pope Douglas Waste-to-Energy Facility. Under the Board of Water and Soil Resources, $4.2 million for the local government road wetland replacement, $10 million for reinvest in Minnesota RIM, and $1 million for Minnesota River Area 2 grants. The Minnesota Zoo is $15 million for the master plan and $6 million for asset preservation. Under administration, $8.075 million for asset preservation, and that includes $75,000 for the governor's residence pre-design. $2 million for statewide CAPRA, $100,000 for the public servant memorial in Eagan, and $2 million for the local cooperative services grants. And then down to public safety, we have $6 million for Camp Ripley, Phase 2. That was a $10 million request, but there were two pieces, and $4 million was for some housing, and so we're not doing that piece of it. $3 million for the Maplewood East Metro Fire Facility, $1 million for the Merit Center in Marshall, $750,000 for the Emergency Operations Center in Minneapolis, $2.8 million for the Joint Public Safety Building in Princeton, and $1 million for the Scott County Safety Training Facility. Under Amateur Sports Commission, $5 million for the National Volleyball Center in Rochester, $4 million for the Regional Sports Center in Moorhead, $2 million for the Mighty Ducks Grants Program, and that is specified to go to Big Lake, Dassel-Cocado, Fergus Falls, and New Hope, and $950,000 for the Women's Hockey Center at the National Sports Center in Blaine.
That one, they've got a 10-year contract with the Women's Olympic team, and with the facilities they had, and they wanted to sort of upgrade them to accommodate that hockey team for the next 10. It's training for the women's hockey. So that one came in kind of late, and but they made a good case for it, so we put it in.
Under military affairs, we have $4 million for asset preservation, $1 million for facility life safety, $900,000 for ADA, $5 million for the Cedar Street Armory renovation, and $1 million for the Troop Support Activity Facility renovation at Camp Ripley. Under transportation, we have $67 million for local bridges, and we're specifying $1 million for Fairmont, $1.5 million for Fergus Falls, Hennepin County gets $10 million for the Lowry Bridge, and Minneapolis gets $7 million for the Northtown Rail Yards Bridge.
Now, these are very heavily leveraged. The Lowry Bridge, for example, is $140 million, I think, and this can probably get that going. You know, we could have just put $50 million down, which we normally have for the local bridges, and then listed these others separately, but we just chose to put the $67 million, and then it really gets it down to about $50 million that's discretionary that they can just do as they decide to do with it. Go ahead.
Greater Minnesota Transit Facilities, $2.5 million. Railroad grade warning devices replacement, $2.5 million. And the next six are trunk highway bonds, trunk highway fund bonds. The Rochester Maintenance Facility, $2.2 million. Maple Grove Truck Station, $15.8 million. Arden Hills Training Center, $4.75 million. Little Falls Truck Station, $3.3 million. And the Maplewood Bridge Crew Building, $3 million. The Duluth International Airport is $11.7 million.
I should mention on that one, that'll get us $42 million in federal money, so there'll be over about like $53 million worth of construction for our $11 million, and that'll create a tremendous amount of jobs for that $11 million that we come up with.
Okay, the Chisholm-Hibbing Airport is $2 million. Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority, $6.5 million. Rail Service Improvement Program, $2 million. The St. Paul Hoffman Rail Yards, $100,000. The North Star Extension, $1 million. Port Development Assistance Program, $3 million. And the Thief River Falls Regional Airport Hangar, $2.097. And under the Metropolitan Council, we have $10 million for Metropolitan Regional Parks, $1 million for the Inver Grove Heights Swing Bridge, $500,000 to Hennepin County for the Midtown Farmers Market, $2 million for the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board Sculpture Garden, $3 million for inflow and infiltration abatement grants, $11 million for the Como Zoo and Conservatory, $1 million for the Theodore Wirth Olympic Training Center, and $30 million for Transit Capital Improvement Program. Under Health, there's $5 million to Hennepin County for the hyperbaric chamber and $20 million to Ramsey County for the Gillette Children's Hospital. Under Human Services, we have $3 million for asset preservation and $2 million for the early childhood grants and $125,000 for the grave markers for deceased residents and cemetery ADA improvements. Under Veterans Affairs, there's $4 million for asset preservation and $450,000 for the Laverne entrance enclosure. Under Corrections, $8 million for asset preservation and $3.529 for Oak Park Heights for their perimeter security fence detection system. Under Deed, $475,000 for the Bemidji Headwater Science Center, $2.217 for the Chatfield Arts and Community Center, $500,000 to Hennepin County for the African American Museum, $13.9 to Mankato Civic Center, $5.3 million to Minneapolis Granary Road, $14.1 to Minneapolis Orchestra Hall, $1.5 to the City of Ramsey Water Recycling Treatment Plant, $34 million to the Rochester Mayo Civic Center, $15.1 million to the St. Cloud Civic Center, $3 million to St. Louis County for their Arrowhead Amateur Sports Complex, $5 million to St. Paul for the Asian Pacific Cultural Center, $15 million to St. Paul for the Ordway Center, $250,000 to St. Paul for the Regional Baseball Facility, $20 million to Greater Minnesota Business Development Program, and that specifies $1 million to North Branch Business Park and $200,000 to the Pine Tech. $4 million to bioscience grants and $10 million to the redevelopment grant program with $2 million specified to Lake Elmo. Under the Public Facilities Authority, we have $10.8 for the drinking water state match and $19.2 for the clean water state match and $27 million to the wastewater infrastructure fund.
There's a tremendous amount of federal money matching this. I think it was going to be like a total of $400 million that will be spent on this coming year with this amount of state money. So, and the need out there is about $2
billion. Then to the
go ahead.
Housing Finance Agency, $10 million for public housing rehabilitation. Under the Historical Society, we have $3.4 for Historic Sites Asset Preservation, $9.357 for the Oliver Kelly Farm, and $1 million for county and local grants And under that, we specify $150,000 for the Air Force Veterans Museum.
Okay. That pretty well lays out the bonding bill. And any other additional comments that you?
Well, we did try to look at what is shovel ready, as we say. And working with the university and the Minsky, they took that into consideration when they put theirs together. And that was the question we asked of so many of these different projects. Are you ready to go? Now, of course, even if they're ready to go, they have to put out bids and so on. It takes a little time. That's why we want to get this done in February, and by April they're ready to go. But we've tried to, as much as possible, figure out how many jobs were going to be created by this bill. And it probably is, we probably concentrated on that much more this year than we did have in the past.
Senator Langseth up in the Red River Valley, as you get further north, we use the explanation that we have 9 months of winter and 3 months of tough sledding. Mm-hmm. But, so we have to take advantage of those 3 months of tough sledding to get the projects built. There are a couple of amendments that I have, and I think these are clarifying, and one is the A5 amendment that, actually deals with the rail authority, and it just, if you look on page 37, talking about that Minnesota Valley rail track rehabilitation, on line 28, after rehabilitation, you would add the words "and make capital improvements too." And I think it clarifies what the project really was supposed to be. So,
Chairman, I'll move that.
Senator Olson moves that amendment. Senator Langseth.
Yeah, I was made aware of that, and that's fine. I support it.
Okay. All right, on that amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. There's another one that I don't have an amendment for, but... Oh, okay, I guess it did get printed. This, Senator Anderson, you probably will... it's on page 27, and I thought we had this cleared up last bonding bill, but on page 27, on lines 13 and 14, you'll see that reference there. It says, as defined in Minnesota Statute Section 84.02, and for members who are not familiar with that, this has to do with the when you have a project where you need you plant Minnesota native grasses or native seeds. I'm not sure if it was a couple years ago or what, but we had extensive hearings in the past showing that you really can't do that. They had a 25, Representative Wagenius put this provision in where you had to buy the seeds within, I think, 25 miles of the project. Mm-hmm. And people all over the state are saying, well, we don't have seeds within 25 miles. And many of you who are on the Environment Committee and Senator Anderson, who chairs the Environment Finance Committee, where we had language I thought worked out that said where it's practicable. But this locks it in where it forces them to spend enormous amounts of money, and sometimes they can't even fulfill that requirement. And so I'd like to get that out of there because it somehow, I think, just accidentally got in there.
Mr. Chair, every time
you pick that statute up, Senator Anderson.
And I didn't notice this in the bill, and so I appreciate you bringing it up. And I thought we repealed 84.02, that section, but maybe in the end of the conference committee, it's...
I don't think it did.
I'm looking for Mr. Jasky. Did that end up staying? That 25-mile language is still in law? Because we do have compromise language that's we put everywhere else in statute, and I'd like to just make sure that's that would apply.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, John Jasky, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. And to Senator Anderson's question, I believe that the statute still does exist, and what we had written into various bills was ways to deal with it, so to speak, as the chairman mentioned. And we developed guidelines on how to implement those provisions in statute, which implemented those flexibility provisions as well. So we've got guidelines. We would support being able to utilize those guidelines, which I think the chairman is trying to accomplish here.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I think this is I'm fine with not referring to 8402, because I think we all agreed that's not workable. But I would like to make sure that we maybe say we could maybe add a couple words that would say that it should be done according to Bowser guidelines or something like that, because they have really worked hard to come up with guidelines that are agreed to by growers, by the scientists, et cetera, that we've talked about before.
Senator Anderson, I think what we do want to do is to delete that reference, and then I think the projects basically will operate under the guidelines. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes. All of the funding that comes through our agency will be subject to those guidelines.
Yeah,
so. Okay. Senator Olson?
I'll move that.
Okay. On the deletion of that, on line 13 and 14, between the two commas, well, actually, the 13 and 14.
Mr. Chairman?
All those in favor, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, to give some comfort to those who are afraid that this might not happen, I would move to insert where the deletion occurred as required by the Board of Soil and Water Resources. And that's Mr. Jasky just told us. It's a little superfluous, but it would make it abundantly clear.
Well, why don't we deal with the First Amendment first, and then you can offer that amendment. I mean, I have no problem with it, because I think the guidelines is what we want, and that's what they're trying to do. But as long as you have that in there, somehow that this language lingers around, and I thought we had it clarified last year, so... But what we want to do is not to have to have all these projects comply with those that 25 miles.
And Mr. Chair, I think we're in agreement with that.
Absolutely.
I think Senator Frederickson is just trying to clarify that the Bowser guidelines would apply instead, and I think that's the sort of the consensus position. So I think it would improve the amendment, and everybody would be on board with that, just to make it clear what they've already said.
Well, Senator Frederickson, would your amendment then be
delete the language and insert.
So it would still
delete and insert, or
yes.
Delete
okay.
and insert.
Exactly.
All right.
And what I suggested to insert as required by the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Okay. On Senator Frederickson's, Senator Olson, do you want to withdraw your motion, or do you include that?
It's an amendment to the amendment.
If Senator Olson is in accordance with the amendment, you could just incorporate it. Otherwise, we can
accept. Yeah, I'll incorporate it.
Okay. On Senator Olson's motion as amended, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frederickson.
Oh. Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment, the A14 amendment.
Okay, if we could have distributed the A14 amendment.
I know.
I have some of those things.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Frederickson.
When the amendment comes around, I'm going to make a couple changes to the amendment. I was going to increase funding for one project that's in here and insert another project, but I'm going to delete the increase that's in the amendment. So, Mr. Chairman, maybe the easiest way would be as I'm going to move the amendment except for line 16.
Well, I'm not sure all of us have it. Let's just wait. This amendment is not necessarily complicated, but if you're going to start making changes.
I
that number right?
Okay, I think we all have it. Senator Fredrickson on the A14 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I'll offer the A14 amendment, except with the following changes. Delete line 16, and on line 17, delete 18 million and insert 19 million. Yeah.
I was wondering who did your math.
So, Mr. Chairman, what that leaves in the amendment is the regional sports commission project for Southwest Minnesota at Marshall. And it would appropriate $1 million to the Southwest Regional Amateur Sports Center at Marshall. This is the amateur sports programs in Minnesota have been very successful. The Blaine Complex was the first to be constructed, and it's very successful. Has a lot of use. Other facilities around the state have been very successful, but those that have been pursued by the Amateur Sports Commission. There are two regions of the state that have not had facilities constructed yet. Even though they've been working on those facilities, they're ready to go. One is at Moorhead in the Northwest region. The other is in the Southwest region of Minnesota, and that's centered around Marshall. The Marshall project was recommended by the Amateur Sports Commission. I know Senator Langseth was under constraints of what he could put in the bill and what he had to leave out, and the Southwest regional one was left out. The Marshall community and the regional area has been working on this Southwest Minnesota Regional Center for the last few years. The last 3 years, they've done a considerable amount of work on this project. They have funded the pre-design with local monies. They are ready to move forward. And it's Marshall is already a regional center for athletic activities. They draw teams and kids from South Dakota, Iowa, North Dakota for some activities. But this would expand what they have to offer to soccer and also softball. And in addition, it would tie together Southwest Minnesota State University, the high school. They have a new high school at Marshall with a new campus. These facilities would be on either the SMSU campus or the Marshall Public School grounds. The community is very much behind it, as are the business community, including one of the major industry leaders in Minnesota that happens to be headquartered in Marshall. So this would at least allow them to get started with their facilities in Marshall. It's $1 million. The request was for $4 million. And to keep the bill balanced, I reduced the amount to the Greater Minnesota Business Development Grant Program from $20 million to $19 million.
And Senator Fredrickson, or maybe it would be better asked to Senator Langseth, what happens with the reduction of the 20 to the 19?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe if you look in the bill, there are a couple projects that are specified. Yes. But it's nowhere near the 19 or 20 million. It would mean that the deed would have $1 million less for that grant program. Even though there are different programs, I would argue that this would also be going towards economic development because sports tourism, amateur sports tourism, is a big deal. You heard the argument for Rochester, how it fills hotels on weekends, brings people to the community, and this will very much do that. It'll draw people from around Minnesota, South Dakota, Iowa, and North Dakota.
Mr. Chair, I guess the one I got, it reduces it to 18, and you changed it.
It's the math.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Langseth, I know you're reluctant to make many changes, so I deleted one of my changes from the amendment. Okay. In hope of appeasing.
Well, this morning I was thoroughly chastised because I had anything for the Amateur Sports Commission. It's up to the committee.
Okay, do we have further discussion on the part of the committee? Okay, Okay. Senator Frederickson moves the A14 amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
I'm sorry, I thought I heard somebody say, okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Further amendments?
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, thank you, members.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment, an oral amendment I'll just offer. It's very simple. It's the same language on page 28 and 44, and it relates to Como Park.
I'm sorry, what page, Senator
it
Anderson?
It starts on page 28, line 29. And I will just delete the words, the polar bear and gorilla. And then, Mr. Chair, I do the same thing on page 44.
Here, right here, down at the bottom of page 28.
Lines 21 and 22, delete the polar bear and gorilla. If everyone has that, let me explain.
Is there a lobbyist here on behalf of the polar bears who would like to...
Yeah, object. I know it's a little discriminatory, but, you know, Senator Langseth, I listened to him present the bill yesterday, and he made a really good case that some people get sort of hung up on animals, funding animals, and really this project is really about families and providing a free place for millions, literally millions of visitors to come and learn about animals and have a very low-cost recreation, or no-cost recreation option. And I think we should stress that. This is about restoring infrastructure. It's not as much as we love the animals. It's really more about restoring infrastructure. And I think it's important to highlight that, just as the Minnesota Zoo has been very articulately highlighted that in their proposal.
Mr. Chair, if you remember, this issue was thoroughly demagogued in the past about people loved gorillas better than children. And when I go to these zoos, and I've been to both of them several times, it's young families with young children. And as Senator mentions, this particular one, Como, doesn't cost a nickel. If you don't have a nickel, you don't pay a nickel. Mm-hmm. And I really, this one has been on there several times, and I certainly hope it survives this time, but and the wording may help that situation. So I support the change.
Okay, we have Senator Anderson's motion in front of us. Senator Olson?
I missed the language of what she's changing.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'll repeat it.
Because it's not in writing. So.
Yeah, if you go to page 28.
I'm there.
Delete, okay, on line 29, delete the polar bear and gorilla. And then it will read, sufficient financing to complete phase two renovation of exhibits at the Como Zoo. And the same thing on page 44, exactly identical language.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I love that Como Zoo, and I'm as far down south as you can possibly get in this state. I was there a little while ago and looked at the flowers out. Quite a thing. I'm going to support this. I think it's a good idea because I've already got criticized in my local paper for voting for monkey cages. So I might just as well. I might as well do something that is right. And I'm going to support you 100% because I think this is a great zoo. I go to that one. I never go to the other one, but don't tell them that.
Hey, you just did.
How the world knows, see?
Well, Mr. Chair, I really sincerely appreciate that, and I just want to remind members that Como Zoo has more. It's the second most visited attraction in the state of Minnesota, right after the Mall of America, where people fly in from around the world to shop. People from around the state, your district, and everywhere else in the state come to visit Como Zoo, and it needs a little bit of support so that we can maintain it and keep it free and accessible for everyone. And for some reason, some people seem to have a blind spot and think that penguins at the Minnesota Zoo are worthy of supporting, but gorillas and polar bears are not. And to me, we all love zoos, and they're a fantastic resource for our state, so we should support them both.
Okay, we have Senator Anderson's motion. Senator Vickerman, I, too, am a big fan of the Como Zoo, but I would encourage you to go to the Minnesota Zoo as well.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to extend an invitation to Senator Vicker, but I'll pay your way in, and we'll pick you up.
All
right. Some cheese curls or whatever they're called, curds or whatever.
All right. It's a simple amendment as we're tossing away the polar bears and the gorilla language. All those in favor of Senator Anderson's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I have the A7 amendment.
if we're going to get off this.
For operation, you can turn to page 49.
Well.
And as this is being passed out, Mr. Chair, I'll explain a little bit. This amendment would delete the language related to the exterior intrusion detection system upgrades at Oak Park Heights and insert for the same amount of money language to put the Department of Corrections onto the armor radio system. And Mr. Chair and members, you've over the last couple of years heard probably quite a bit of talk about the importance of having radio systems that people can talk from one entity to another. And in the I-35W bridge collapse, part of the reason why the work there was so successful was that every different agency could talk to each other. Recently, we had an incident at Stillwater Prison, and what we found out was that the corrections officers couldn't talk to the neighboring police department, and they couldn't talk to the county sheriff's departments because the radios were incompatible. The Federal Communications Commission has mandated that all public safety radio systems must migrate to narrowband operations by January of 2013. And if we don't start this now, we will not be in compliance, and we will be fined heavily for it. And so the other thing I wanted to say was that the division ranked the radio system upgrade higher than the fence at Oak Park Heights, as did the Department of Corrections. And Commissioner Crist is here to give you more information if you would like it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we found out in the committee yesterday that we had the priorities a little different than they wanted, and talked to them afterwards, and this is fine with me. I think it's amendment.
Okay, Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I agree that we need to put money into this communication system, but it does trouble me a little bit that we're taking it out of another area of public safety and corrections. I would have a little different priority. I haven't had time to think about it quickly, but the public safety area and corrections area of the bill here are not that substantial compared to some other areas. And I do think that those areas are things that the state really has responsibility for, a very high priority responsibility. And so I would, I'll support this now, but I hate to see the loss of the money for the prison facility. And I think that we should probably think about where else that money could come from.
Further comments on Senator Higgins' amendment, the A7 amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, is there, I was just trying to look at the two. Are we giving up something to achieve something else, or to what extent does what you're proposing accomplish some of the same ends? Is there any correlation between the goals of the two?
Sir.
Or are they two in isolation? I mean, is there vigilance that needs to be communicated that the system would take care of, essentially, that would be as effective as the proposal that's being funded in there now? I'm trying to help you here, but if it's a, am I just jumping to conclusions that there's no correlation? You've got a system that you think should have priority over the upgrade in the bill.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Mr. Chair, I think and maybe the commissioner is probably a better person to say this than I, but I think that the existing perimeter fence is getting old, as is, everything else in state government. It's getting old. But they can continue to patch it up for a while. Meanwhile, if the corrections officers don't have the capability of talking with one another or talking with their outside agencies that are really important if anything ever does happen, then we could be in a world of trouble. Oak Park Heights is an interestingly built facility. It is built more or less in a circle, and then it's earth bermed on the outside, and then all the outside access is into the inside courtyard. So even if you could get out, all you could do is get into the courtyard where you can't get out. And we asked in our division whether anybody's ever escaped from this facility, and they said no. I asked if anybody had ever gotten as far as the fence, and they said no. So I think the department would agree with me that the radios at this point are really a higher priority than the repair of the fence.
Thank you.
The fence is still operational.
Thank you.
And Senator Roblin, I want to make sure that you didn't misunderstand that, or that I didn't misunderstand yourself.
Probably.
That the Higgins Amendment doesn't change the dollar amount.
Right.
It just substitutes one proposal. Because you were concerned about the amount of appropriations in the bill for corrections, and so this amendment doesn't change that, doesn't diminish the amount.
Right, Mr. Chair. I'm glad she is doing this right now, but I wasn't. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with her taking it away from the fence, although if it is indeed operational yet, that's good. But there are some other areas of the bill that I felt we could have swapped with other than in the corrections department.
Okay. Further questions on our comment on the A7 amendment? Senator Higgins has moved the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I have an A11 amendment. And while it's being handed out, Mr. Chairman, I'm offering this for Senator Bach, and all it does is change the date. It doesn't change any appropriations in the bill. It's from from the 2006 bonding bill, and it was an appropriation that was made to the City of Tower for a marina development, which has some significant federal and local funds that are also contributed to it. They haven't gotten to the point where they've accessed the bonds yet, so we just need to change the date so that the bonds are still available in 2013.
Senator Bach, did you wish to comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this was some money that the legislature bonded for deeds redevelopment account. They did give an award of almost $1 million to the City of Tower for a pretty significant marina development that's going to access Lake Vermilion. But it's a multi-jurisdiction project with the Army Corps and MnDOT. MnDOT has to be the lead on it because they have to relocate a highway before any of the basin work can be done, before the Army Corps can actually start dredging. And there just isn't an opportunity to expend this money until the other jurisdictions have performed their work. MnDOT is going to award the contract on the relocation of the highway on June 1st of this year, I understand. So that'll really get the project underway. But it's been quite an undertaking because of all the multi-jurisdictions. So appreciate the committee's support.
Mr. Chair, what normally happens if there's no activity within 4 years, it drops off. But we have in many cases when it's obvious that it's going to happen, change the dates. And a lot of times there's some particular reasons why it wasn't able to proceed, and this would be just one of those cases. So I don't have any problem with the amendment.
How much was that fishing?
Okay. Further questions on the our discussion of the 11th Amendment? All those in favor? Senator Anderson?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to ask Senator Bach if this was a $700,000 fishing pier.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, this is going to be probably about a $8 million basin that through the East Two Rivers will directly connect the City of Tower once it's redredged by the Army Corps to the lake. It's a pretty significant, and it used to be a marina prior to the building of the new highway, and most of it was filled in, and they're reestablishing a marina from decades ago.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to respond to Senator Anderson. I was watching television last night, too, and I thought, did we do that? And we looked back, and it said $650,000 for piers. No designation, but somehow, I don't know what happened after that, But we did not say there was going to be a pier built in this small lake for $650,000. It's just $650,000 for piers. So I you know, felt pretty good about it because I didn't want to answer to, you know, it's pretty hard for me to say I didn't know it was in there. Well, I carry the bill, you know. But it was kind of interesting. But I don't know what happened between the time there was that general appropriation in the bill to the point it all went to one pier.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. I'm glad it wasn't in my district.
All right, we have Senator Tomasoni's motion in front of us. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Bach. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, before Senator Bach leaves, I wonder if I could offer an amendment that pertains to up there, too.
A16.
I'm sorry. This is out of. This is flying. I'm flying just solo here. So, and I haven't had a chance to talk to anybody about it. But it's regarding the Vermilion State Park, the change that does need to be made to allow that to go forward, which is the repeal of just a piece of the language from last year's bonding bill. Would you have any problem with that just going in here to be a part of the dialogue?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I actually have been working with DNR, and I actually introduced the bill. And I'm not sure if I got a number yesterday or not, but there actually is a bill that I worked with DNR on relative to the provisions that the administration needs to execute the park. So I think it would probably be better to take it through the committee process. And one of the issues, for instance, is right now we have the Sedan Underground Mine State Park. Now we're going to have the Vermilion State Park. They have a contiguous boundary. It seems like, why don't we have one park instead of two right next to each other and to avoid, you know, building additional bureaucracy of two park managers when it's really one mass of land contiguous. I think there's some other issues probably worth discussing relative to the park boundary that are incorporated into the legislation that I've been talking with DNR about. So I think today's probably not the best day to do it.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Sir Olson.
All this did was just take out that 12% above appraised value limitation so that the deal could go forward by May 1st because there is a deadline to it, and I just thought it ought to get into play. But if you think this we can do it all in one package, I don't have any problem with that.
Mr. Chairman, it's in my larger bill relative to the park.
Thank you,
Chair.
I'm glad. Just stay. Sir. I'll withdraw that amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that this should go through the committee process. It's as Senator Bach said, I agree with him. And, you know, we've been talking with the commissioner about the numbers. We want to make sure we do our due diligence on this, and it needs some discussion, and it needs vetting. But we'll certainly be hearing the bill and be, you know, considering this in our division. So we'll have plenty of time to get this decision made and just so it wouldn't hold the deal up if that's what the legislature decides to do. But I think it should be done through – we should have a hearing on it.
Thank you. Thank you all. Mr. Chair, I withdraw that.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I've got four amendments. If we can get them all passed out at the same time, that would be good. It's 1 through 4.
Okay. Well, let's – you want to have a second look at – are these amendments all – Mr. Murphy, there's...
They're transportation-related, Mr. Chairman.
So. Okay.
And they're all kind of... They're all about transportation. I want to get them off the table here quick, and we're running the pages to death with... So we might as well do four at once.
Mm-hmm. Well, at Senator Murphy's request, let's offer the staff a minute to pass everything out.
You want to come to my jobs? Get you to say something. What's your like jobs?
What we have is 9:30.
Roble. She can hear that over there.
Is this an amendment coming?
Look it up here. Don't leave now, files.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, is this all trunk highway?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Langseth, no, it's not. And if you want me to get going here, we can start with the A1 amendment real quick. And
okay, does everybody have the A1 amendment? Senator Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, the A1 amendment is an issue that arose recently in the Minnesota River Watershed District. And there's the port down in, well, that's to keep the rivers navigable. The Army Corps comes in and they dredge every so often to keep the channels at least 9 feet so the barges can move up and down. The Port of Savage is heavily used, especially in times of fall when we're moving farm commodities back and forth. What's happened is the Army Corps, you know, they're on the hook for pulling the silt out of the river, but the states are on the hook to place the silt. And right now there's not a site that is that has been prepared to, there's not a site that's been acquired and prepared to place this dredge spoils on. This would put $225,000 towards that. My understanding is that that this is part of the House bill currently. And I wanted to make the committee well aware of this because when the bill comes back from conference committee, I'm hoping that this is going to be in. And I'm going to withdraw the A1 amendment. But, folks, this needs to happen. Otherwise, come this fall, we're not going to have access to a very critical port on our river system. And, you know, for the farmers and people that move commodities around, we all know that moving them up and down on the river is absolutely the cheapest form of transportation. So, Senator Langseth, this is going to be part of the House bill. And if you'd take a close look at it, then I sure would appreciate it because this – it's like I said, it adds $225,000 to the bottom line on your bill.
Mr. Chairman, you're making that as a suggestion, not
making
as
this as a suggestion.
Okay,
at this time.
That's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
I've heard about the situation.
Okay, great. Now, Mr. Chairman, the next three amendments that I have are all designed to basically save money and push projects ahead inside MnDOT. The first one is the A2 amendment. This amendment, if you look down past lines 21 down further, when we authorized MnDOT in the 07 finance bill, we authorized them over $200 million worth of bonding approval to bring home projects, to deliver these projects through their program delivery. What we're doing here is if you see down on lines 27, those bonds were to be let between 11 and 18. What we're doing is we're capturing those last 2 years of bond authorizations, and we're going to pay them forward. We're getting such, and we heard from finance, whatever their new name is, they're getting, we're bringing projects home cheaper than ever before. We've saved millions of dollars, MnDOT has, I should say, in their contract letting over the past year just because we're getting things so cheap and the interest rate is, it's as close to zero as you're going to get. And so what we're doing is we're capturing that $100 million in 17 and 18, and we're going to spend it between 2013 and 2016. I think everybody's going to be happy. The debt service with MnDOT can easily handle this. So I would move the A2 amendment.
Okay. Senator Langston?
Mr. Chair, I guess I wish I had known about some of these things before I put my bill together, but I don't think I have any problem with that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lang said, I apologize for that. We were going to do this trunk highway thing a little bit different than we did our others, but the time, the clock ran out. And
okay. Further questions on the amendment? Again, this is the A2 amendment. Senator Murphy moves the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer up the A3 amendment now. And members, the A3 amendment goes towards this grant agreement that has to be put in place before anybody can spend any bonding dollars. Now, and the Department of Transportation hasn't really had to do this until this past year. And let me tell you, here you get, this is how you fill out your request to get the money that we authorize. Okay, first, here's the instructions to fill out the application. 3 pages long. Anytime you need 3 pages of instructions to fill out 28 pages of application, something's wrong. Now, MnDOT's been taking care of this all on their own. They've been their own fiscal agent since, I don't know, since dirt roads?
1929,
Senator Foley is telling me. We haven't ever had to do this. This adds cost to the project. Now, I know finance, whatever their new name is, they're going to come up and they're going to say, oh, but we need to do this. Everybody else has to. MnDOT has never had to do this. It's a waste of time and resource. Talk to your county engineers. Talk to your township officials. You know, we all come from areas where there are townships, and our township officers, they put their name on the line every time that they enter into an agreement with MnDOT on a road project. They vote yes or no, and they're directly accountable to the same people we are. This grant agreement does nothing but add cost and time and hassle to delivering projects, especially at the local level. The A3 amendment just tells MnDOT that they don't have to go through this dog and pony show. And I would renew my motion on the A3 amendment.
Senator Langseth, the A3 amendment.
I don't quite understand the amendment, but I'll accept it. Senator Murphy is supposedly the transportation king, so.
No. Mr. Chairman, that's Representative Leader.
He's okay. Mr. Langseth, I thought you were in the past.
Yeah, for 14 years.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to be he's just trying to eliminate another hoop that really isn't necessary. It's the stuff is going to go forward anyway, so why? This is the kind of stuff that we do that adds cost to our processes, mm-hmm. and we're having to cope with in a myriad of ways. So I think it's a good direction, and we ought to agree to support
it. Thank you, Senator Olson. And Mr. Chairman, before people in finance get all upset with MnDOT folks, this is my initiative. I asked the commissioner several months ago that if there's anything out there that doesn't add value to putting concrete and rebar in the road, I want to know about it. This was at the top of the list. So this is my request. So if finance isn't happy, don't run and get after the MnDOT people. You know, this is just one of those things that we don't need to do.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Roblin.
Thank you. I was involved with the development of the bill for the Grants Management Office. And at the time, I don't know that we had any problems with MnDOT and their grants. And so perhaps they shouldn't have been included. I don't know for sure. We did have problems with accountability for a number of state grants, and it was quite frankly an embarrassing situation for us. And so we needed to have more accountability, and we have more oversight in place now. And we have a director who is doing what I think is a very good job with that. But if there was an area that never had problems, maybe it didn't need to be included. I'll support this for now, but I need to ask that office a little more to see if they think that they have a good reason to get out.
All right, thank you, Senator Roblin. Further discussion or questions on the A3 amendment? If not, on Senator Murphy's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and the last one is the A4 amendment, and I would move that amendment. Members, you know, when I started, I said I'm going to save some money here, and I think the last couple saved some money. This one in the long term is going to save money. Once again, we've been getting projects, or MnDOT has been accepting bids on projects all across the state that are coming in some areas, millions of dollars less than what we had anticipated. The borrowing rate is very cheap. You know, they've been doing one heck of a job. And this is another way for us to throw a little gas on their fire. This has to do with the Rochester maintenance facility. Now, their request, MnDOT's request, was the $26.4 million to completely design and construct that building. And these are trunk highway bonds, so it doesn't count against Senator Langseth's bottom line. And, but bottom line is this building and this facility needs some serious upgrades. And they're not, you know, we're not building this building, you know, with gold leaf on the ceiling and things like that. This is just a basic MnDOT building. And if anybody's been to MnDOT buildings, that's what they are, just basic buildings. They store salt in their trucks, and they house some people in little tiny cubicles. And this is going to improve that condition and also improve that facility. Now, Senator Sinjum has made several suggestions that this facility should be moved outside of town. I can tell you that in long term for MnDOT, that's going to add a lot of expense to them. This facility sits kind of at the crossroads of a lot of state trunk highways right in Rochester. And, you know, when you send a plow truck out and they can drop the plow within two blocks of leaving the parking lot and start plowing snow, that's a good thing. But if you have to drive 15 miles before you drop the plow, you've just wasted 15 miles of diesel fuel. And you've just wasted at least 15 minutes of that driver's time when they could be performing a public service. I understand that, you know, this is a valuable piece of property, but talking with the district engineer and a lot of other people that I know around Rochester, you're not going to be able to buy property in the city limits any place close to the accessibility that this piece of property has for what you're going to get out of it if you sell it. I mean, that's just the way it is. The price of property in Rochester is still pretty high. If you move it outside of town, then you're going to add even more and more costs to people who are jumping in those plow trucks and cleaning up our roads. So I would move the A4 amendment.
Sir Langseth?
It's up to the committee.
Okay, on that vote of confidence from Senator Langseth, Senator Murphy moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor signify by Senator Rogel.
I just have a question of Senator Murphy. When we take the money for highway buildings, it's money that can't go into roads, right? It's from the Trunk Highway Fund?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, it's bonding money, and that would be true. That would be a portion of this of the money that we normally would spend for roads. But we've got state buildings all across the state, and we need to upgrade those facilities from time to time. So,
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Murphy, how did we have $2.2 million? Was that just for part of an upgrade, and now we're going to 26? I don't understand the big difference here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, I'm sorry. The 2.2 was just to get ready to do the construction. The full number, the 26 million, is to do everything. You know, we were just doing design and, you know, your basic work, like we do on a lot of other projects. You know, I kind of phase them in. But like I said, with this, we're getting money for so cheap now, and labor is down, and the price of concrete and everything. And the department's ask was the 26.4, and I'm just putting that in there so that they can get it done this year.
Thank you.
Okay, further discussion on Senator Murphy's motion on the A4 amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Yeah.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
I have an A13 amendment that I'd like to offer. And
if we could have that distributed.
This bonding committee yesterday. Did they make things change?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, as the amendment's handed out, now I'm offering this for Senator Chaudhry. This I do not know very much at all about. It relates to a project in Fridley, and it's the Springbrook Nature Center in Fridley. I don't believe, at least I wasn't present when we had gone around, if we did go around and visit that, but so I don't, Senator Langseth, I just was made aware of this, so I would too.
I support this project by not taking
it. Senator Chaudhry, did you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Stumpf for offering the amendment, not on the Finance Committee, so I appreciate you doing that for me. This is relates to the Springbrook Nature Center in Fridley. This project has been in the Senate's bonding bill three times, and this year it was recommended by the Environment Finance Committee to be funded. Found out late that it was not in, and so I've spoke with Senator Langseth about putting this putting the project back in to try and get this passed finally. It is a it really should be called a environmental learning center because it serves the region and hundreds and thousands of people in the region and across the state and actually outside of the country every year. As I explained in the Environment Committee, if this just served Fridley or the immediate surrounding areas, we would not need this bill. But the bonding committee has visited this site in the past and has recommended it. And so I'm asking the – I didn't have time to come up with an amendment to figure out how to balance the bill from in yesterday's Capital Investment Committee, which I do sit on. But this is an amendment, you know, I'm not trying to take away from any other projects. I'm open to suggestions on how to do this. The way it was suggested from staff was to take this, to take it out of, or not to take it out of, but to designate it amongst the Metropolitan Council Parks, the $10 million in the bill for Metropolitan Parks, which is not designated. Metropolitan Parks, I'm sure, has plans for the money. Like I said, this bill has been in the this has been a priority for the Senate for a number of cycles, and I'd like the opportunity to have this on the Senate side as well. The House is doing this for a lesser amount. The need is $3 million. In fact, the need is probably more because the $3 million was the original estimate 6 years ago, but we're still only asking for the $3 million. I've spoken with Senator Langseth about it, you know, hopefully we can get it passed this year through the governor, as with many of the other projects.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry is right. We've had this as a priority three different times, and the guy in the corner office wants it out every time. And when we were putting the bill together, of course, we looked at some of this and tried to figure out what we can get past the governor and what we couldn't. So the reason it wasn't in the bill had nothing to do with the merits of the issue. Our bonding committee was up there, I think it was twice probably. It's a great project, and it's on a park that's over 100 acres. So I'd like to have it in law, but we've never been able to get it there, and I guess
I'll have to say that is the reason that when we were putting together a billion-dollar bill, it wasn't in there. It appeared that no matter what we did, the government was going to veto it anyway. So I guess that was my reasoning. I did feel bad about it because we all liked it. I mean, the committee really, really liked the project.
Mr. Chair?
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chair, I would be interested in just finding out a little bit more about what the Metropolitan Council priorities. This would this come under that category? Because it appears that it is, and I'm not really familiar with it, it appears that it is a local park, and it would be a local nature center. And I think maybe that's the hang-up that comes if the governor's is vetoing things that appear to be designated strictly local rather than regional. And I don't know what the Met, but I don't know what the Met Council is doing with their priorities and how this fits in with that. If it would be just a designation of one of those. Is there anybody from the Met Council that could fill us in a bit more on that?
There's somebody here from the Metropolitan Council?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, this proposal has always been, when we put it in, has always been under the Met Council category. I wouldn't say that this is part of the Met Council's park plan. Because we've always had it separate, so I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't part of their official plan this year. But we've had a chance to have some of the governor's staff out to the Springbrook Nature Center this interim to try and explain that even though in name it appears to be a local deal, that it is really not. It is a facility that assumes not only a regional but a statewide burden. It serves thousands of people, and we've heard this in bonding. We've heard this in the Environment Committee about the hundreds and thousands of people that this nature center serves from around the state. And so it really is a statewide project. We've tried to help the governor understand that this is not something local. I should also add that the citizens of Fridley passed in a referendum an increase in their property taxes to help fund the ongoing costs of this nature center. But because of the volume of people it serves, kids mainly, we need help from the state because it does serve the entire state.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, then the nature center exists, or is it the property that exists? Is there a structure there now? Or so this is just expanding it or modifying it or what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, modifying it. There's a plan to increase the capacity, the classrooms. It's about 150 to 200 acres within the city of Fridley that is being loved to death. We really need help if we're going to continue to serve people from all of your communities to be able to expand the classroom space, improve the facilities. There is a alternative energy plan for it. But we just need help, and we've done it in the past. This has been in our bills, and I've asked the committee to consider this. I'm open to suggestions on how to get this in. This was the best idea that we could come up with for the moment on short notice, and so this doesn't have to be the permanent solution to take it out of the Met Parks fund, but. We need to get this in the bill again this year so we can pass it.
Jim thinks this is. Mayor Anderson.
Mr. Chair, first I want to say this is a great project, and our division did recommend it, and I'm disappointed it's not in the bill. It does have regional significance, but it's not part of the Metro Park system. It's not one of the Metro Regional Parks, and so they have a very specific list of priorities, and this would take away $3 million worth of those existing priorities. So I talked to Senator Chaudhry about this. I'd love to see it in the bill. I'm glad it's in the House bill. If there's a way we can put a placeholder in here, maybe we could add a little bit to the bill, but Senator Langseth probably doesn't want to do that, but I don't know where else. But this is the wrong place to take the money from because it would take away projects that have been waiting in line and approved and gone through the prioritization process. So I I have a problem with the way the amendment is set up, and it would, if we could find another way to do it, I really support this project. It's a, it really does serve a broad regional area, and you know, we've supported it year after year, so I'd like to find a way to do it, but I just don't want to hurt the Metro Parks in the process. And I appreciate that Senator Langseth has funded their request to meet those needs in the Metro Parks. And I just can't vote against that. That's my problem.
Silverwood Park.
Is there some other part of the bill we could look at? That, Mr. Chair, that's what I would want to do, but I can't support this amendment as drafted.
Mr. Chairman, I was committed to stay below a billion. I've got $36 to go.
I see you got give a $36 upgrade. Yeah.
Give it to Shocker. That's probably not much of a placeholder, is it?
Oh, I was well, like I said, you're Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, and I'm not wedded to this approach. It's what I could come up with was at least rational, given the timing of it. And so I'm happy to keep working on it. But what I don't want to do is end up in the double bind of saying it wasn't in the bill, and therefore this project, which has been in line longer than a lot of the Met Council regional parks, doesn't get considered at all.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The line for Met Parks is really long. I know some of them have been waiting a very long time, and as Senator Anderson said, they have a very strict priority list, and it kind of ruins the system when some of them try and jump out and come in with separate bonding proposals, because actually it's the way they set it up is designed to make it easier for us, because they take care of the priority if we give them the lump sum. And it doesn't have to be decided politically, but it can be decided based on merit and all the criteria they have. So I do feel as strongly as Senator Anderson about protecting that fund and rewarding those who have patiently waited in that long line over the years.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf.
Maybe in light of the concerns... we could continue to work on that and maybe have some ideas, and Senator Anderson and others might work with Senator Chaudhry to come up with some suggestions. So I'll withdraw the amendment.
Senator Stumpf, you're the person moving the amendment. Just if Senator Chaudhry wants to do that, time is limited to work between now and the floor to see if Senator Langseth would have any other place to...
There is conference committee as well, as we know. Now, obviously, senators like to have their project in the Senate bill, and I certainly understand that. I did make a big mistake. I said there was $36 left. There's $36,000 left. But I'm not sure if it would enhance the project to have a placeholder.
All right, that's the total.
$30,000 is that probably would do more harm than good. But it's been our priority in the past, and it just gets to the point where you think some of this stuff isn't going to make it unless we have a change in the corner office, which we will next year. But I don't know. That was the reason it isn't in there. It wasn't because it wasn't a good project. Now, who's closing the shades there?
I don't know.
There's something.
Let there be light. Make them go up now, whoever just did that.
Well, Senator Stumpf was the maker of the motion. He's withdrawn the amendment unless somebody else wants to reoffer it.
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
All right. Okay, well, thank you, Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you.
Do we have other amendments in front of us? Members, any other amendments?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. I have the A19 amendment. As it's being handed out, it's on page 34, and it has to do with the Scott County Regional Training Center. And it's really just a clarifying amendment. I didn't have time to even talk to Senator Langseth. As I was reading through the bill, I realized there was a sentence that had been omitted that was critical, which we discovered in 2008, and we had to do a correction at that time, so that the MMB could appropriately deal with this, with the bond for this. All it asks is it's a sentence that's added that says amounts committed to this project from non-state sources since June 2nd, 2006 may be counted for the non-state match. And the reason we need this is because when Scott County and its collaborators started this project, they put a lot of money into it up front, millions and millions. And they don't really have more money to put in, although they still have some more projects within the project to complete. And so they've already more than probably we've gotten $2 million from the state, and they've probably spent about $8 million on the project so far. And so we already have the match greatly more than 2-1, but we have to look back to see that match back to 2006.
Sir Langton?
Mr. Chair, I was familiar with the project in my district, that it did seem like they went back, even without the language, they went back to what the city had done and so on. I'm not sure if it's needed, but I don't have a problem with it.
And Mr. Chair, we did have a little problem with it in 2008. I recall we had to have a little correction put into the supplemental bill, I believe, later on, or they wouldn't be able to do it that way.
Yeah, I don't have a problem.
Okay, we have Senator Roebling's motion in front of us on the A-19 amendment. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Further amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I don't really have an amendment, but I just want to draw members' attention to page 41 of the bill.
What page?
41. Senator Langseth was good enough to Senator Langseth was good enough to put some money in here for some improvements that need to happen behind the Capitol for light rail. Most of this is surface adjustments that need to be made, keep pedestrians safe and everything. All needs to happen. The one thing that isn't funded in the bill, we may only get one chance at that, but people should talk with administration about the tunnels, about our tunnel system. We're only going to get one chance to fix these tunnels underneath the road back here before they start laying track. Once they lay track, we're done. And we got tunnels that go all over the place. The tunnel from across the street underneath University Avenue is the first one that could be done in conjunction with the light rail project, but we don't have any money for it. But it definitely needs to happen. I don't know what the answers are here, and I don't want to add, I think the project is about $20 million. I don't want to add another. You might be a little over your limit then.
It's more than $36, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think we can get a tunnel for $36, but this is going to have to happen, Mr. Chairman, and we're going to have to scrape together some dollars to make it happen, and we're going to have to scrape it together this year because I just don't see anybody giving us authority to go and tear up rail track after it's been laid down. I think that would, we need $20 million to get this first leg done, Mr. Chairman, is what I'm saying.
Mr. Mossman?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, very minor technical amendment on page 60, line 12, the date for the bond schedule. It should be the biennium ending June 30th, 2011.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that.
Okay, Senator Frederickson makes that technical motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frederickson.
Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 2360 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
All right. On Senator Frederickson's motion, is there further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rickman.
Just one comment. I want to personally thank Senator Langseth for what you've done for military and veterans. And I know it wasn't easy, but they come out of this more, they should be more than happy with this. And I want to personally thank you as chair of that committee for how hard the work you did. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right, thank you, Senator Rickman and Senator Langseth. On the Frederickson motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Committee is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Back
Roebling.
Bring the stuff back to the office, including not the amendment.